Reed? The name drops a hush over the room. At the door, Farley turns her face, hiding in shadow. I stare at Gisa, searching my sister's pretty face. She's 15 now, settling into herself. Her face used to be rounder, her freckles less numerous, and she didn't have the cares she has now, just the usual worries. It used to be little Gisa we relied on. Her skill, her talent, her ability to save our family. Not anymore. She doesn't begrudge the loss of that weight. But her concern is clear. She doesn't want it on my shoulders either. Too late. Gisa, Mom says, her voice a low warning. I recover as best I can, pulling my hand away. My spine turns to steel. We need to request more troops, and Premier Davidson's government has to approve before they can be sent. I'll help present our coalition, show them who we all are. Make a convincing argument for the war against Norda and the Lakelands. My sister is unconvinced. I know you're good at arguing, but you aren't that good. No, but I'm the crossroads, I say, dancing around the truth of it. Between the Scarlet Guard, the Silver Courts, the New Bloods, and Reds, too. I'm not lying, at least. And I've had enough practice putting on a good show. Farley balances her baby in one arm, putting her other hand on her hip. She drums a finger against the holster of the pistol glued to her side. Mare's trying to say she's a good distraction. Where she goes, Cal follows. Even now, when he's trying to win back his throne, he's coming with us to Montfort, and so is his new betrothed. Behind me, I hear Calorne suck in a hissing breath. Gisa is just as disgusted. Only they would stop to arrange marriages in the middle of a war. For another alliance, right? Calorne sneers. Maven did it already. Locked up the Lakelands. Cal needs to do the same. So, who is it? Some girl from Piedmont? Really cement what we're doing down here? It doesn't matter who she is. My fist clenches in my lap as I realize that I'm lucky it's Evangeline, a girl who wants nothing to do with him, another chink in his flaming armor. And you're just going to let this happen? Calorne paces out from behind the sofa, his long limbs making even strides. He glares between Farley and me. No, excuse me, you're going to help? Help Cal fight for a crown no one should have, after everything we've done? He's so upset I almost expect him to spit on the floor. I keep my face still, impassive, letting him fume. I can't remember him ever being so disappointed in me. Angry, yes, but not like this. His chest rises and falls rapidly as he waits for my explanation. Farley does it for me. Montfort and the Scarlet Guard won't fight two wars, she says evenly, emphasizing the words, conveying a message. We have to take on our enemies one at a time. Do you understand? My family seems to tighten in unison, their eyes going dark. Dad especially. He runs a thumb along his jaw, thoughtful, as his lips press into a thin line. Killorn is less subdued. Green fire sparks behind his eyes. Oh, he murmurs, almost smiling. I see. Bree blinks. I don't. No one is surprised, Tramie mutters under his breath. I lean forward, eager to make them all understand. We aren't going to give the throne to another Silver King, at least not for long. The Calor brothers are at war, spending their forces fighting each other. When the dust settles, Dad drops his hand on his knee. I don't miss the tremble in his fingers. I feel it in mine, too. It will be easier to deal with the victor. No more kings, Farley breathes. No more kingdoms. I have no idea what the world could look like, but I might soon, if Montfort is everything I've been promised. If only I still believed in promises. We don't bother trying to sneak out. Mom and Dad snore like trains, and my siblings know better than to stop me. The rain hasn't let up, but Killorn and I don't mind. We walk down the row house street without speaking, the only noise coming from our feet squelching through puddles as the storm rumbles in the distance. I can barely feel it anymore, as the lightning and thunder spiral away toward the coast. It isn't that cold, and the well-illuminated base keeps out the darkness. We don't have any real destination. No direction but forward.
He's a coward,
Killorn mumbles. He kicks at a loose pebble. It skitters away, spreading ripples across the wet street. You said that already, I reply, along with a few other things.
Well, I meant it.
He deserves every word. Silence drags over us like a heavy curtain. We both know this is strange territory. My romantic entanglements aren't exactly his favorite subject, and I don't want to inflict any more pain than I already have on my closest friend. We don't have to talk, he cuts me off, putting a hand on my arm. His touch is firm, but friendly. The lines between us are clearly drawn, and Killorn values me enough to never cross them. He might not even feel the same as he did before. I've changed so much in the last few months. It's possible the girl he thought he loved is gone. I know what that's like, too. To love someone who doesn't really exist.
I'm sorry, he says. I know what he means to you.
Meant, I growl, trying to push past him. But his grip tightens.
No, I didn't make a mistake. He still means something to you, even if you won't admit that.
It isn't worth the argument.
Fine, I admit it.
I force through clenched teeth. It's dark enough that he might not notice my face turning scarlet. I asked the Premier, I mumble.
Killorn will understand. He has to understand.
I asked to keep him alive. When the time comes, when we turn.
Is that weakness?
Killorn's face falls. The harsh streetlights illuminate him from behind, giving him a halo. He's a handsome boy, if he isn't already considered a man. If only my heart fell to him instead of someone else.
I don't think so, he says. Love can be exploited, I guess, used to manipulate. It's leverage. But I would never call loving someone else a weakness. I think living without love at all, any kind of love, is weakness. And the worst kind of darkness.
I swallow thickly. The tears don't feel so immediate anymore.
When did you become so wise?
He grins, shoving his hands in his pockets.
I read books now.
Do they have pictures? Barking a laugh, he starts walking again.
You're such a kind person.
I match his pace. That's what I hear, I reply, glancing up at his lanky form. His hair is soaked through now. Darker in the wet, almost brown. Killorn could be shade if I squinted. Suddenly, I miss my brother so much, I can barely breathe. I won't lose anyone else the way I lost shade. It's an empty promise with no guarantees, but I need some kind of hope. I need some kind of hope, however small it may be.
Will you come to Montfort?
The words blurt out of me, and I can't bite them back. It's a selfish request. Killorn doesn't have to follow me around everywhere I go, and it's not my place to demand anything of him. But I don't want to leave him behind again.
His responding grin erases any trepidation I might have.
Am I allowed? Thought it was some kind of mission. It is, and I'm allowing it.
Because it's safe,
he replies, eyeing me sidelong. I purse my lips, searching for an answer he might accept. Yes, it is safe, or the closest thing we have to safe. It isn't wrong to want him out of danger.
Killorn brushes my arm.
I get it, he continues. Listen, I'm not about to storm a city or shoot jets out of the sky. I know what my limitations are and how many I have compared to the rest of you. Just because you can't kill someone with a snap of your fingers doesn't make you less than anyone else. I fire back, almost electrified with sudden indignation. I wish I could list all the wonderful things about Killorn, all the important things he is. His expression sours.
Don't remind me.
I grab his arm, nails digging into wet fabric. He doesn't stop walking. I'm serious, Killorn, I say. So you'll come? I'll check my schedule. I dig my elbow into his side and he jumps away, forcing an exaggerated frown.
Stop it. You know I bruise like a peach.
I elbow him again for good measure, both of us laughing as much as we dare. We continue on quietly, lapsing into an easy silence. This time it isn't so stifling. My usual worries melt away, or at least step back for long moments. Killorn is my home too, as much as my family. His presence is a pocket of time, a narrow place where we can exist without consequence. Nothing before, nothing after. At the end of the street, a figure seems to materialize from the rain, shedding drops of dark and light. I recognize the silhouette before my body has time to react. Julian. The gangly silver hesitates when he sees us, only for a second, but it's enough time for me to know. His side is chosen, and it isn't mine. Cold bleeds through me, from fingers to toes. Even Julian. As he approaches, Killorn nudges me. I can head back, he whispers. I glance at him briefly, drawing strength from him. Please don't. His brows knit with concern, but he nods curtly. My old tutor still wears his long robes, despite the rain, and he shakes water from the folds of his faded yellow clothing. No use in it. The rain keeps pelting down, smoothing out the slight curls of his gray-streaked hair.
I was hoping to catch you at home, he calls over the hissing downpour. Well, honestly, I was hoping to catch you indisposed so I could do this in the morning, instead of out in this infernal wet. Julian shakes his head like a dog and pushes his hair away from his eyes.
Say what you came here to say, Julian. I cross my arms. As the night falls, so does the temperature. I might catch a chill, even here in steaming Piedmont.
Julian doesn't reply. Instead, his eyes flick to Killorn, one eyebrow raised in silent question. He's fine, I say, answering before he can ask.
Speak up before we all drown out here.
My tone sharpens, and so does Julian. He isn't a fool. His face falls, reading the disappointment etched on me.
I know you feel abandoned, he begins, choosing his words with maddening care.
I can't help but bristle. Stick to history. I won't let you lecture me on what I'm allowed to feel. He only blinks, taking my response in stride. Again, he pauses, long enough to let a raindrop roll down his straight nose. He does it to gauge me, to measure, to study. For the first time, his patient manner makes me want to seize him by the shoulders and shake some impulsive words out of him.
Very well, he says, his voice low and wounded. Then, in the interest of history, or what will very soon be history, I am still accompanying my nephew on your journey west. I would like to see the Free Republic for myself, and I think I can be of use to Cal there.
Julian starts to take a step forward, toward me, but thinks better of it. He keeps his distance.
Does Tiberius have some interest in obscure history that I don't know about?
I scoff, the words coming out harsher than usual. He looks torn. That much is very clear. He can barely look me in the eye. The rain plasters his hair to his forehead, clings to his lashes, pulls at him with tiny fingers. It smooths him out somehow, as if washing away his days. Julian seems younger than when I met him, almost a year ago. Less sure of himself, full of worry and doubt.
No, he concedes.
While I normally encourage my nephew to pursue all knowledge he can, there are some things I'd like to steer him away from. Some stones he should not waste time trying to overturn.
I raise an eyebrow. What do you mean?
Julian frowns. I assume he mentioned his hopes for Maven before.
Before he chose the crown over me.
He did, I whisper, sounding small. He thinks there might be some way to fix his brother, heal the wounds of Ilara Mirandis.
Slowly, Julian shakes his head.
But there is no completing a puzzle with missing pieces, or putting a shattered pane of glass back together.
My stomach twists, tensing with what I already know, what I've seen firsthand.
It's impossible. Julian nods. Impossible and hopeless, a doomed pursuit, one that will only break my boy's heart.
What makes you think I still care about his heart?
I sneer, tasting the bitter lie.
Julian takes a wary step forward.
Go easy on him,
he murmurs. I snap back without blinking. How dare you say that to me?
Mare, do you remember what you found in those books?
He asks, pulling his robes tight around himself. His voice takes on a pleading edge.
Do you remember the words?
I shiver, and it isn't because of the rain. Not a god's chosen, but a god's cursed.
Yes,
he replies, nodding along with fervent motion. It reminds me of the way he used to teach, and I brace for a lecture.
This is not a new concept, Mare. Men and women have felt that way in some capacity for thousands of years, chosen or cursed, fated or doomed, since the dawn of sentience, I suspect, and long before silver and red or any type of ability. Did you know kings and politicians and rulers of every kind used to think they were blessed by the gods, ordained to their place in the world? Many thought themselves chosen, but a few, of course, saw the duty as a curse.
Next to me, Killorn puffs out a low scoff. I'm more obvious, rolling my eyes at Julian. When I shift, so does the collar of my shirt, sending a steady drip of rainwater down my spine. I clench my fists to keep from flinching.
Are you saying your nephew is cursed to his crown?
I sneer. Julian hardens, and I feel a tinge of regret for being so callous. He shakes his head at me, like I'm a child to be scolded.
Forced to choose between the woman he loves and what he thinks is right? What he thinks he must do because of everything he's been taught to be? What else would you call that?
I call it an easy decision,
Killorn growls. I bite down hard on the inside of my cheek, trying to gnaw back a dozen rude responses.
Did you really come here to defend what he did? Because I'm certainly not in the mood for it.
No, of course not, Mare,
Julian replies, but to explain, if I can.
My stomach churns at the thought of Julian, of all people, explaining his nephew's heart to me. With his dissections and ruminations, will he boil it down to simple science? An equation to show that the crown and I are not equal in the prince's eyes? I simply can't stand it.
Save your breath, Julian.
I spit.
Go back to your king. Stand at his side.
I look him dead in the eye, so he knows I'm not lying.
And keep him safe.
He sees the offer for what it is, the only thing I can do. Julian Jacos bows low. He sweeps out his soaking robes in an attempt at courtly manner.
For a second, we could be back in Somerton.
Just him and me in a classroom piled with books. Back then I lived in terror, forced to masquerade as someone else. Julian was one of my only refuges in that place, alongside Cal and Maven, my only sanctuaries. The Kalor brothers are gone. I think Julian might be too.
I will, Mare, he tells me. With my life, if I must.
I hope it doesn't come to that.
So do I.
Our words are warnings to each other, and his voice sounds like a goodbye. I think Bree keeps his eyes closed for the entire flight, not to sleep. He just really despises flying, so much so he can hardly look at his own feet, let alone peek out the window. He doesn't even respond to Tramie's and Gisa's gentle teasing. They sit on either side of him, content to poke and prod. Gisa stage whispers to Tramie, leaning across Bree to say something about jet crashes or engine malfunctions. I don't join in. I know what a jet crash feels like, or at least close to it, but I won't spoil their fun either. We get so little of it these days. Bree keeps still in his seat, arms tightly crossed, his lids glued shut. Eventually his head lolls forward, chin resting on his chest, and he sleeps the rest of the way. It's no small accomplishment on his part, considering the route from the Piedmont base to the Free Republic of Montfort is one of the longest flights I've ever taken. 6 hours of flying, at least. Too long a journey for a drop jet, so we're on a larger carrier, a transport more like the Black Run. But this isn't the same craft, thankfully. The Black Run was torn apart last year by a contingent of Samos warriors and Maven's own fury. I glance down the fuselage to the silhouettes of two pilots working the jet. Men of Montfort. I don't know either of them. Killorn hangs at their backs, watching them fly. Like Bree, Mom isn't keen on the flight, but Dad twists with his forehead glued to the glass, eyes on the land as it sprawls out below. The rest of the Montfort escort, Davidson and his advisors, spend the time sleeping. They must intend to hit the ground running when they get home. Farley sleeps too, her face pressed up against her seat. She took a spot without a window. Flying still makes her ill. She is the only representative from the Scarlet Guard. Even in sleep, she curls her arms around Clara, rocking with the motion of the jet to keep her settled. The colonel is back at the base, and probably ecstatic about it. With Farley gone, he's the highest-ranking member of the Scarlet Guard left behind. He can play command all he likes while his daughter relays information back to the organization. On the ground, the verdant green of Piedmont, braided with muddy rivers and rolling hills, steadily gives over to the floodplain of the Great River. The disputed lands line both banks, their borders strange and always changing. I know little about them, except the obvious. The Lakelands, Piedmont, Prairie, and even Taraxis, farther south, fight over this stretch of mud, swamp, hill, and tree. For control of the river, mostly. I hope. Silvers fight for nothing most of the time, spilling red blood for less than dirt. They control this land, too, but not as tightly as they do Norta and the Lakelands. We fly on, heading west over the flat grasslands and gentle hills of prairie. Some is farmland, wheat sprouts in golden waves, patchworked with corn in endless rows. The rest looks like open landscape, pocked by the occasional forest or lake. Prairie has no kings that I know of, no queens, no princes. Their lords rule by right of power, not blood. When a father falls, his son does not always take his place. It's another country I never thought I'd see, but here I am, looking down at it. It never goes away, this strange feeling bubbling up from the odd divide between who I was before and who I am now. A girl of the stilts, of familiar mud, trapped in a small place until the doom of conscription. My future was so empty then, but was it easier than this? I feel detached from that life, 1,000,000 miles and 1,000 years ago. Julian isn't on our carrier, or else I might be tempted to ask about the countries beneath us. He's on the other air jet, the Laris jet, striped yellow, with the rest of the Kalor and Samos representatives, as well as their guards, not to mention their baggage. Apparently a would-be king and a princess require a good deal of clothes.
They trail behind us, visible from the left side windows, metal wings flashing as we chase the sun. Ella told me she came from the prairie lands before Montfort, the Sandhills, Raider Country. More terms I don't really understand. She isn't here to explain, left behind at the Piedmont base with Rafe. Titan is the only Electricon coming with us. Besides me, of course. He's Montfort-born. I suspect he has a family to visit, and friends, too. He sits near the rear of the jet, sprawled across two empty seats, his nose buried in a tattered book. As I look at him, he feels my gaze, and he meets my eyes for a brief second. He blinks, gray orbs calculating. I wonder if he can feel the tiny pulses of electricity in my brain. Does he know what each one means? Can he distinguish between bursts of fear or excitement? Could I, one day? I hardly know the depth of my own abilities. It's the same for all new bloods I've met and helped train. But maybe not in Montfort. Maybe they understand what we are and how much we can do. The next thing I know, someone nudges my arm, jolting me out of an uneasy sleep. Dad points at the rounded window between us, set into the curved wall behind our seats.
"Never thought I'd see anything like that," he says, wrapping the thick glass.
"What?" I ask, adjusting myself. He snaps the buckle on my belts, giving me full range of motion to turn and look out. I have seen mountains before, in the Great Woods, from the Notch. Green ranges fading into autumn's fire, and then winter's barren, bone-branched chill. In the rift, where hunched ridges ripple into the horizon, rising and falling like leafy waves. In Piedmont, deep in the backcountry, their slopes shifting into blue and distant purple, glimpsed only from the windows of a jet. All of them were part of the Alatias, the long line of ancient mountains marching from Norda to the Piedmont interior. But I have never seen mountains like the ones before us. I don't think they can even be called mountains at all. My jaw hangs open, eyes glued to the horizon as the jet arcs toward the north. The flat prairie lands end abruptly, their western edge punctured by the wall of a vast and sheer mountain range, bigger than anything I've ever seen before. The slopes rise like knife edges, too sharp, too high, rows upon rows of jagged, gigantic teeth. Some of the peaks are bare, without trees, as if trees can't grow up there. A few mountains in the distance are capped in white snow, even though it's summer. I draw in a shaky breath. What kind of country have we come to? Do Silvers and Ardents rule so completely, with enough strength to build an impossible land like this? The mountains put a fear in me, but a little excitement, too. Even from the air, this country feels different. The Free Republic of Montfort stirs something in my blood and bone. Next to me, Dad puts a hand to the glass. His fingers brush over the silhouette of the range, tracing the peaks.
"Beautiful,"
he murmurs, so low only I can hear.
"I hope this place is good to us."
It's cruel to give hope where none should be. My father said that once, in the shadow of a stilt house. He sat in a chair, missing a leg. I used to think he was broken. I know better now. Dad is as whole as the rest of us, and always has been. He just wanted to protect us from the pain of wanting what we could not have. Futures we would never be allowed. Our fates have been quite different. And it seems my father has changed with them. He can hope. With a deep breath, I realize the same. Even after Maven, my long months of imprisonment, all the death and destruction I've seen or caused, my broken heart still bleeding inside me, the unending fear for the people I love and the people I want to save, it all remains a constant weight. But I won't let it drown me. I can still hope, too.
6. Evangeline. The air is strange, thin, oddly clean, as if removed from the rest of the world. I smell it around the edges of my iron, my silver, my chrome, and of course the metallic tang of the jets, their engines still hot from the journey. The feel of them is overpowering, even after long hours cramped in the belly of a Laris carrier. So many plates and pipes and screws. On the flight, I spent longer than I care to admit counting rivets and tracing metal seams. If I tore there, or there, or there, I could send Cal or Annabelle, or anyone I wished, plummeting to their death. Even myself. I had to sit near a Haven Lord for much of the trip, and his snore rivaled thunder. Jumping out of a jet almost seemed like a better choice. Despite the time of year, the air is colder than I expected, and goosebumps rise beneath the sheer silk draped over my shoulders. I took care to dress as a princess should, even though now I suffer the chill for it. This is my first state visit, both as a representative of the Rift and as the future queen of Norda. If that cursed future comes to pass, I must look the part. Impressive and formidable down to my painted toes. I have to be prepared. I am well beyond the bounds of the world I understand. I inhale again, sucking down an oddly shallow breath. Even breathing here is unfamiliar. It isn't late enough for sunset, but the mountains are so tall, and already the light wanes. Long shadows race across the landing field, cut deep into the valley. I feel as if I could touch the sky. Run my jeweled claws across the clouds and make the sky bleed red starlight. Instead, I keep my hands at my sides, my many rings and bracelets hidden beneath the folds of my skirt and sleeves. Decoration only. Pretty, useless, silent things. Just like my parents want me to be. At the far end of the jet runway, the land drops away in a cliff. The carved edges of the mountainsides frame the horizon like a window. Cal stands silhouetted, looking eastward, where evening falls in shades of hazy purple. The mountain range casts shadows of its own, and all the world seems to fade in a darkness of Montfort's making. Cal isn't alone. His uncle, the infinitely odd Jaqos Lord, stands at his side. He jots something in a notebook, moving with the excited, nervous energy of a tiny bird. Two guards, one in Laralan colors, orange and red, with the other in Laris yellow, flank them from a respectful distance. The exiled prince stares out, still but for the wind in his scarlet cape. Reversing his house colors was a smart decision, to distance himself from everything King Maven is. I shudder at the memory of that white face, those blue eyes, how every part of him seemed to burn with an all-consuming flame. There is nothing in Maven but hunger. Cal doesn't turn around until Mare is off her jet with her family, hustled to a waiting escort of Montfort attendants. The Barrow's voices echo off the stone walls of the high mountain valley. That family is quite vocal. And for someone so short and compact, Mare has surprisingly tall brothers. The sight of her younger sister turns my stomach. The girl has red hair, darker than Elaine's, without any of her bright gleam. Her skin doesn't glow, not with ability or some inner charm I can't explain. She isn't pale or alluring, either. Her face is plainly pretty, more golden, an average sort of beauty. Common. Red. Elaine is singular, in appearance and mind. She has no equal in my eyes. But still, the Barrow girl reminds me of the person I want most, the person I can never truly have. Elaine isn't here, and neither is my brother. That is the price. For his safety, for his life. General Farley will certainly kill him if given the opportunity, and I don't intend to let her have it. Not even for my own heart. Cal turns around to watch Mayor disappear, his eyes on her back as the escorts lead her and her family away. My lip curls at his idiocy. She's right in front of him, and he still pushes the girl away with both hands. For something so fragile and fickle as a crown. Even so, I envy him. He could still choose her if wanted. I wish I had the opportunity to do the same.
You think my grandson is a fool, don't you?
I turn to see Annabelle Larrilan watching me, her lethal fingers knitted in front of her, a rose-gold tiara winking on her head. Like the rest of us, she made an effort to look her best. Gritting my teeth, I dip into a shallow but perfect curtsy. I have no idea what you mean, Your Majesty. I don't bother trying to sound convincing. I see little consequence to it, for good or ill. It makes no difference what she thinks of me. She controls my life either way.
You're attached to the Haven girl, yes? Gerald's daughter.
Annabelle takes a daring step closer to me. I want to cut Elaine's face right out of her head.
If I'm not mistaken, she's married to your brother, a future queen as much as you are.
The threat laces through her words like one of my mother's snakes. I force a laugh. My passing fancies are not your business. One of her fingers ticks, tapping against a wizened knuckle. She purses her lips, and the wrinkles around her mouth deepen.
They are very much my business, especially when you lie so quickly to keep Elaine Haven from any kind of scrutiny. A passing fancy.
Hardly, Evangeline. You are clearly smitten.
She narrows her eyes.
I think you'll find you and I have more in common than you believe.
I smirk in her face, flashing my teeth in a veiled snarl.
I know old court gossip as much as anyone else.
You speak of consorts. Your husband had one, a man named Robert. And you think that gives us what, an understanding?
I married a Kalor king and sat by his side while he loved another. I think I know how this,
she dances two fingers in front of me,
might work. And let me tell you, it works best when all parties involved are in agreement and in the know. Whether you like it or not, you and my grandson need to be allies in all things. It's the best way to survive.
Survive in his shadow, you mean? I snap, unable to help myself. Annabelle blinks at me, her face pulled in rare confusion. Then she smiles and tips her head.
Queens cast shadows, too.
Her demeanor changes in an instant.
Ah, Premier.
She turns to my left toward the man standing behind me. I do the same, watching as Davidson steps forward. He nods at both of us, though he never breaks his gaze. His angled eyes, oddly gold, dart from Annabelle to me. They are the only part of him that seems alive. The rest, from his empty, bland expressions to his still fingers, seems schooled by restraint.
Your Majesty. Your Highness,
Davidson says, bobbing his head again. Over his shoulder, I glance at his Montfort guards in green, as well as his officers and soldiers with their insignia. There are dozens of them. Some accompanied him from Piedmont, but most were already here waiting for his arrival. Did he always have so many guards at his back? So many guns? I feel the bullets in their chambers. I count them off, a force of habit, and thicken the pools of iron in my dress, covering my most sensitive organs. The Premier gestures with one hand, sweeping his arm.
I hope to escort you both into our capital, and be the first to bid you welcome to the Free Republic of Montfort.
Though he still does his best to remain emotionless, I sense a pride in him. Pride in his home, his country. I understand that, at least. Annabelle surveys him with a look that would level noble silvers,
men and women of terrible power, and even worse, arrogance. The Premier doesn't even flinch. This, she sniffs, eyeing the naked cliffs on either side of us, is your republic.
This, Davidson replies, is a private runway.
I spin a ring on my finger, distracting myself with the braid of jewels to keep from laughing. Buttons gleam at the edge of my awareness, heavy iron, well-formed, forged into the likeness of flame. They approach, fastened to my betrothed's clothing. He stops at my side, radiating a low but constant heat. Cal says nothing to me, and I'm glad for it. We haven't truly spoken in months. Not since he escaped death in the bowl of bones. Before, when he was my betrothed for the first time, our conversations were few and dull. Cal has a mind for battle, and Mayor Barrow. Neither interests me much. I sneak a look at him and can tell his grandmother has seen to his appearance as well. Gone is the rough-cut hair and the uneven stubble across his jaw. His cheeks are smooth. His black hair neat and glossy, brushed back from his forehead. Cal looks like he just stepped out of Whitefire, ready for his own coronation, instead of a 6-hour flight on a jet carrier with a siege behind him. But his eyes are dull, hard bronze, and he doesn't wear a crown. Either Annabelle could not procure one for him, or he refused to put it on. I assume the latter.
A private runway?
Cal asks, looking down at Davidson. The Premier doesn't seem bothered by the height discrepancy. Maybe he is without the infinitely male preoccupation with size.
Yes, Davidson says. This airfield is at higher altitude and has easier access to the city of Ascendant than the fields on the plains or the valleys deeper in the mountains. I thought it best to take us up here, although the eastern ascent up the Hawkway is considered a splendid sight. When the war is over, I'd like to see it,
Cal replies, trying to be polite. It does little to hide his naked disinterest. Davidson doesn't seem to mind.
When the war is over,
he echoes, his eyes glittering. Well, we wouldn't want to make you late for your address to your government. Annabelle puts her arm through Cal's, ever the doting grandmother. She leans on him more than she needs to, a fitting and calculated picture.
I wouldn't worry about that,
Davidson says with one of his easy, languid smiles.
I'm scheduled to speak before the Montfort Assembly in the morning. I'll make our case then.
Cal jolts.
Tomorrow morning. Sir, you know as well as I do that time the Assembly convenes in the morning. Tonight I hope you'll join me for dinner,
Davidson says placidly.
Premier,
Cal begins, gritting his teeth. But the new blood is forceful and stern, albeit as apologetic as he can be.
My colleagues already agreed to hold a special session, out of season. I assure you, I'm doing what I can within the bounds of my country's laws.
Laws? Can they even exist in a country like this? With no throne, no crown, no one to make the ultimate decision while all the rest squabble over details? How can Montfort hope to survive? How can they hope to move forward with so many pulling in different directions? But if Montfort cannot move, if Davidson cannot win Cal more troops, then this war may end the way I want. It may end sooner than I thought. To Ascendant, then? I ask, hoping to get out of the settling cold and get Cal closer to all the distraction this place can give. As Annabelle has already claimed Cal, I offer my arm to Davidson instead. He takes it with a slight bow, his hand feather-light on my wrist.
This way, Your Highness, he replies.
I'm surprised to find that the touch of a new blood is not as revolting as the touch of my betrothed. He sets a good pace, leading us away from the jets and onto the paths leading into Ascendant. The city is set high on the eastern edge of the massive mountain range, looking over the lower peaks and out over the borders. Prairie fades on the horizon, its edges known as Raider Country, where roving bands of silvers aligned to no nation prey upon all who cross. The rest is empty plain, marred only by the cratered remains of what was once a city long ago. I do not know its name. Ascendant seems born of the mountains themselves, built upon slopes and into valleys, arching over gushing streams and the larger river picking its way back east through winding canyons. The few roads tunnel, and transports weave in and out of sight. There must be more beneath the surface, carved into the rock hearts of these mountains. Most of the Ascendant city buildings are quarried stone, granite, marble, and rock quartz, cut and sculpted into impossibly smooth slabs of white and gray. Pine trees, some taller than spires, sprout up between buildings, their needles the same dark green as Montfort's flag. The sunset and the mountains wash the city in alternating stripes of deep pink and darkening purple, light and shadow. Above us, marching into the western distance, snowy peaks stand triumphant beneath a sky that seems too big and too close. A few early stars pinprick the dusk. They are familiar, forming patterns I know. I have never seen a city like this, and it worries me. I do not like surprises, nor do I like to be impressed. It means something is better than me, or my blood, or my homeland. But Ascendant, Montfort, Davidson, they've done it. I can't help but be awed by this strange, beautiful place. It's less than a mile to the city, but the many steps make it seem longer. I think the Premier wants to show off, so rather than stuff us all into transports, he forces us to walk and see the city fully. If I were back in the court of a Kalor king with some other noble on my arm, I wouldn't bother making conversation. The presence of House Samos is well reputed. But here, I have to prove myself. I sigh, grip my teeth, and look to Davidson at my side. I understand you were elected to your position. The word is foreign to me, rolling around my mouth like a smooth stone. Davidson can't help but chuckle, a small crack in his inscrutable mask.
Yes, indeed. 2 years ago, the nation voted, and on the third year, next spring, we do so again.
Who voted precisely?
His mouth tightens. All kinds, if that's what you mean. Red, silver, ardent. A ballot is colorblind.
So you do have silvers here? They said as much before, but I doubted any silver would condescend to a life alongside any red, let alone to be ruled by one. Even a new blood. Still, it puzzles me. Why live here as an equal when they could live elsewhere as a god? Davidson dips his chin.
We have many.
And they just allow this? I scoff, not bothering to hold my tongue. I only do that around my parents, and they aren't here, having thrown me to these red-blooded wolves.
Allow our equal existence, you mean?
The Premier's voice takes on a sharper edge, hissing through the mountain air. His eyes bore into mine, gold into charcoal gray. We continue walking, both of us sure, over the many steps. He wants me to apologize. I do not. Finally, we reach a landing, a marble terrace overlooking a wide garden in full bloom. Unfamiliar flowers, purple and orange and pale blue, spiral out before us, wild and fragrant. Some yards ahead, Mare Barrow and her family pick their way through the garden, led by their own Montfort escorts. One of her brothers stoops to inspect the flowers more closely. While the rest of our group takes in the expanse of the garden, Davidson draws closer to me, his lips almost brushing my ear. I resist the urge to slice him in two.
Forgive me for my bluntness, Princess Evangeline,
he whispers.
But you have a female lover, don't you? And you are forbidden to marry her.
I swear, I'm going to cut the tongues from the mouths of everyone here. Is no secret sacred?
I don't know what you mean,
I growl through a clenched jaw.
Of course you do. She's married to your brother. Part of an arrangement, yes?
My hands tighten around a stone railing,
The cool smoothness does nothing to soothe me. I dig in my fingers, and the sharp, jeweled points of my decorative claws scratch deep. Davidson keeps on, his words a tumult, low and fast and impossible to ignore.
If all were as you wished, if you were not a bargaining chip and a crown, and she was not wed, could you marry her? Under the best of circumstances, would the silvers of Norta allow what you desire?
I turn to him, teeth bared. The premier is far too close. He doesn't flinch or step back. I can see the tiny imperfections in his skin, wrinkles, scars, even pores. I could claw his eyes right out of his head if I wanted to. Marriage has nothing to do with desire, I snap. Marriage is for heirs and nothing else. For reasons I can't fathom, his golden eyes soften. I see pity. I see regret. I hate it.
So you are denied what you want because of what you are. A choice you never made. A piece of yourself you cannot change and do not want to change.
I
look down on my country all you want,
he murmurs, and I see a shadow of the temper he works to keep hidden.
Question the way things are. Perhaps the answers will be to your liking.
Then he steps back a little, returning to the picture of a politician, an ordinary man of ordinary charm.
Of course, I hope you enjoy our dinner this evening. My husband, Carmadon, has been busy enough preparing for you all.
What? I can only blink. Of course not, I misheard. My cheeks flush with heat, turning gray with shame. I can't deny that my heart leapt in my chest, a burst of adrenaline coursing through me only to die in a heartbeat. It's no use wishing for impossible things. But the premier moves his head, the slightest nod. I didn't mishear, and he didn't misspeak.
Another small thing we allow here in Montfort, Princess Evangeline.
He drops my arm without ceremony, quickening his pace to put some distance between us. I feel my heart hammer in my chest. Is he lying? Is what he said even possible? To my bewilderment, sharp tears prick at my eyes and my chest tightens.
Diplomacy was never your strong suit.
Cal glowers at my shoulder, his grandmother hanging back to whisper with one of the Eral lords. I turn my head, hiding for a moment in a curtain of silver hair, just long enough to regain some semblance of control. Luckily, he's decidedly occupied with staring after Mare, tracking her movements with pitiful longing. Then why did you pick me? I finally sneer back at him, hoping he feels every ounce of my rage and pain. Why make someone like me a queen when all I'll be is a thorn in your side?
Playing dumb isn't your strong suit either, Evangeline. You know how this works.
I know you had a choice, Kalor. Two paths, and you chose the one that leads right through me.
Choice?
He barks.
You girls love that word.
My eyes roll in my skull. Well, you seem to be a stranger to it, blaming everyone and everything else for a decision you made.
A decision I had to make.
He turns to me, eyes flashing.
Or what? You think Annabelle and your father and the rest would have allied with the Reds anyway, without getting something in the bargain? You think they wouldn't find someone else to back, someone worse? At least, if it's me, I can...
I step neatly in front of him, putting us chest to chest. My shoulders square, ready for battle. A lifetime of training hardens beneath my skin. What? Make things better? When all the fighting is done, you think you can sit on your new throne and wave your stupid flames and change the way the world is? With a sneer, I size him up, my eyes ripping a path from his boots to his forehead. Don't make me laugh, Tiberius Kalor. You're a puppet as much as I am, but at least you had a chance to cut your strings.
And you don't?
I would if I could, I whisper, and I think I mean it. If Elaine were here, if there were some way we could stay...
When the time comes, when we have to marry...
He stumbles over the words. It isn't like a Kalor to stammer.
I'll try to make things as easy as I can. State visits, meetings. You and Elaine can do as you like.
A chill runs through me, as long as I hold up my end of the bargain. The prospect disgusts us both, and we look away from each other.
I'm not doing anything without your consent, he mutters.
Even though I'm not surprised, a tiny burst of relief blooms in my heart. I'd cut something off if you tried. Cal offers a weak laugh, little more than an expulsion of air.
What a mess,
he mumbles, so low he might not expect me to hear. I suck in a shaky breath.
You can still choose her.
The words hang in the air, torturing us both. He doesn't reply, now glaring at his booted feet. In the garden, Mare keeps her back to him, following close at her sister's heels. Despite their differing hair colors, I see the resemblance. They move in the same way, careful, quiet, deliberate, like mice. The sister picks a flower as they go, a pale green bloom with vibrant petals, then tucks it into her hair. As I watch, the tall red boy, the one Mare insists on dragging everywhere, does the same. The flower looks silly behind his ear, and both Barrow sisters double over. Their laughter echoes over us, a taunt more than anything. They are red, they are lesser, and they are happy. How can this be? Stop moping, Kalor, I grind out through gritted teeth. The advice is for both of us. You forged this crown yourself. Now wear it. Or don't.
7. Iris. The banks of the Ohias are high. It was a wet spring, with the southern farms of the Lakelands almost flooding many times. Teora was here in the unstable borderlands just a few weeks ago, to help save the new crops as much as she was to smile and wave. Her small, rare grin won us some favor here, but not enough. Reports to the Crown say that Reds are still fleeing, crossing the hills into the rift to the east. They are fools if they believe the Silver King there will offer them a better life. The smarter ones cross the Ohias into the disputed territories, where no king or queen rules. But they have to risk the chaos of such a journey, facing Red and Silver alike between the Lakelands and northern Piedmont. The rise above the river offers a commanding view of the valley, a good place to wait. I look south, into the woods gleaming golden beneath the waning light of afternoon. Today was easy, filled with travel across the corn and wheat. And Maven was kind enough to take his own transport, allowing me long hours of peace as we rolled south. The journey was almost a reprieve, even if it meant leaving my mother and sister behind. They're back in the capital. I can't say when I'll see them again. If I ever do. In spite of the pleasant breeze and the warm air, Maven elects to wait in his vehicle. For now. He'll certainly try to make some kind of entrance when the Piedmontese arrive.
He is late, the old woman mutters at my side.
In spite of the circumstances, I feel a corner of my mouth lift.
Patience, Chidansa. My, how the current has changed, Your Majesty, she chuckles, the wrinkles on her brown face deepening as she grins. I can remember giving you the same counsel more than once, usually in regard to food.
I break my vigil, looking away from the horizon to glance at her. In that, the current remains true. Her dusty laugh deepens, echoing out across the river. Jidansa of the Marin line has been a friend of the family for as long as I can remember, close as an aunt and doting as a nanny. She used her Telki ability to amuse T and me as children, juggling our shoes or toys with her mind. Despite her lined face, white hair, and matronly disposition, Jidansa is a fearsome opponent, a Telki talented beyond measure, one of the best in our nation. I would ask her to return with me to Norta, if I were not so heartless. She would agree, but I know better than to make such a request. Most of her family died in the war. Living among Nordens would be a punishment she doesn't deserve. Her presence is calming,
Even if we were in the Lakelands, I still feel unease around Maven. The rest of my escort fans out behind me, allowing a respectful distance. The sentinels should make me feel safe, but I can never feel at ease beneath their jeweled gaze. They would kill me if my husband commanded it, or try at the very least. I fold my arms in front of me, feeling the edges of my blue traveling jacket. Even though I'm about to meet a prince of Piedmont, the ruling prince, I look woefully underdressed. Hopefully he isn't as dedicated to appearance as most silvers I know. I don't have to wait much longer to find out. From our vantage point, we can see his convoy picking its way across the disputed territories. The land is otherwise indistinguishable from the woods of the southern Lakelands. There are no walls, no gates, no roads to mark this part of the border. Our own patrols are well hidden for now, and instructed to let the Piedmont prince pass unimpeded. His convoy is small, even compared to our meager group of 6 transports and 50 or so guards. I spot only 2 transports, fast and agile machines, tearing low across the sparser edges of the forest. They're painted in camouflage, a sickly green to match the landscape. As they get closer, I can see the yellow, white, and purple stars dotting their sides. Bracken. Behind me, Metal groans, and Maven steps down from his transport. He crosses the flattened grass in a few quick strides, stopping next to me with even grace. Slowly, he folds his hands. His white skin looks more golden in this light. He could almost seem human.
"I did not take Prince Bracken to be such a trusting man. He is a fool," he says, gesturing to the prince's small party.
"Desperation makes fools of most," I answer coolly. Maven barks out a single laugh. His eyes drag over me in an almost lazy fashion.
"Not you."
"No, not me." This needle must be gently threaded. Like Maven, I fold my hands together, projecting an image of strength, determination, steel. Bracken's children have been missing for months, imprisoned and used as leverage. Every moment they are gone as another bit of Piedmont bled away. Montfort has already cost them millions of crowns, using whatever they get their hands on. Guns, jets, food stores. The military base in the Lowcountry was stripped, with much of its contents shipped back to the mountains. The Montfortans are locusts, feeding upon all they can. Whatever resources Bracken has left are almost spent. The transports coast to a halt some yards away, keeping a safe distance from our own convoy. When they open, a dozen guards troop out, resplendent in dark purple edged in gold. They carry swords and guns, though a few seem to favor warhammers or axes instead of blades. Bracken carries no weapons at all. He is tall, black-skinned, with a smooth complexion, full lips, and eyes like 2 polished stones of jet. Where Maven is draped in his cape, his medals, and his crown, Bracken seems less reliant on style. His clothes are finely made, dark purple edged in gold to match his guards. But I see no crown, no furs, no jewels. This man is here on a dire mission and has no cause for pageantry. The prince towers over us both, with the muscular physique of a strong arm, though I know for a fact that Bracken is a mimic. If he were to touch me, he would be able to use my nymph abilities, albeit only for a time, and to a lesser extent. The same goes for any silver. Perhaps even new bloods, too.
"I wish our first meeting were under better circumstances," he says in a deep, rumbling voice.
As is custom, he ducks into a shallow bow, observing both our ranks. He might rule Piedmont, but his country is no match for ours.
"As do we, Your Highness," I reply, offering a nod of my own.
Maven copies my motions, but too quickly, as if he wants this to be over with as soon as possible.
"What do you have for us?"
I wince at the lack of tact. On instinct, I open my mouth, ready to smooth over the rough edges of a precarious conversation. But to my surprise, Bracken grins.
"I don't like to waste time either," he replies,
his smile taking on a hard edge. Over his shoulder, one of his guards approaches, carrying a leather-bound folio in hand.
Not when my children hang in the balance.
This is your intelligence on Montfort, I ask, eyeing the papers as the guard passes them to her prince. You pulled this together so quickly.
The prince has been searching for his children and for people to help in his endeavor for months, Maven drawls. I remember your envoys, the princes Alexandret and Dorais. I'm sorry I couldn't be of any help to them.
I almost snored aloud. One of the princes died in the Archaon Palace, killed in a failed coup to overthrow Maven himself, and the other is dead too, as far as I know. Bracken dismisses the apology with a wave of one large hand.
They knew the risks, as do all in my service. I've lost dozens to the search for my son and daughter.
There is true sorrow in his words, laced beneath the anger. Let us hope we don't lose any more, I mutter, thinking of myself and what my mother said. It must be you. Maven raises his chin, his eyes flashing between Bracken and the folio. It has to be filled with information on Montfort, their mysterious cities, their mountains, their armies. Information we need.
We're prepared to do what you cannot, Bracken, he says.
Maven is a skilled performer, and he layers his words with just the right amount of sympathy. If given the chance, the young king might lure Bracken to his side before I even get a chance to play my hand.
I understand that, while the Montfortans hold your children, you can't move against them. The smallest rescue mission could jeopardize their lives. Yes, exactly true.
Bracken nods rapidly. He's eating up everything Maven gives him.
Even gathering intelligence was almost too dangerous.
The Northern King raises an eyebrow.
And? We were able to track the children to their capital, Ascendant, the prince offers.
He extends his hand, holding out the folio to us.
It's deep in the mountains, protected by a valley. Our maps of the city are old, but usable.
I take the information before one of the sentinels can, weighing the folio. It's heavy, worth its weight in gold. Were you able to find where they're being held? I ask, eager to crack open the pages and get to work. Bracken dips his head.
I believe so, at great cost.
I cross my arms, cradling the substantial book to my chest. I won't waste it. The Piedmont prince looks me up and down, his face pulled in respectful confusion. Maven is less obvious. He doesn't move, and his expression doesn't change. The temperature doesn't rise a single degree. But I can smell the suspicion rolling off him, and the warning. He's smart enough to keep his mouth shut in front of the prince, unable to stop me from spinning my web. I'm leading the team myself, I offer, fixing Bracken with my most determined stare. He doesn't blink, resolute as a statue. Examining me, weighing me. The simple clothing was a good choice on my part. I look more like a warrior than a queen. I'll use Norton's soldiers and soldiers of the Lakelands, a small enough force to pass through unnoticed. Rest assured, we've been hard at work since yesterday. Even though it makes my skin crawl, I put a hand on Maven's arm. His flesh is cold beneath his sleeve. I can't see it, but I feel the tiniest tremble in him. My smile widens. Maven came up with a brilliant plan. He slides his hand over mine, fingers like ice. A threat, plain as day.
Indeed I did, Maven says, his lips pulling into a feral smile to match my own.
Bracken sees only the offer and the possibility of his children's rescue. I don't blame him. I can only imagine what my mother would do if Tiora and I were in the same position. The prince breathes a long sigh of relief.
Magnificent, he offers, bowing his head one more time. And in return, I can pledge to uphold the alliance we've had for decades, until the blood freaks decided to intervene.
Bracken hardens.
But no more. The tide turns today.
I feel his words as keenly as I feel the river below, flowing in its course. Unbreakable. Unstoppable. The tide turns to day, I echo, the folio tight in hand. This time, Maven climbs into my transport after me, and I'm tempted to kick him back out in the grass. Instead, I retreat to the farthest corner of my seat, Bracken's intelligence laid across my knees. Maven keeps his eyes on me as he sits down. His calm manner almost makes me sweat. I wait for him to speak, matching his icy gaze with my own. Inwardly, I curse his presence. I want to crack into the papers and start filling in the gaps in my rescue plan, but I can hardly start with Maven sneering at me, and he knows it. He's enjoying this, as he always enjoys bothering people. I think it makes him feel better about his own demons, to make demons for everyone else. Only after the transport is moving, hurtling away from the borderlands at high speed, does he speak.
"What exactly are you doing?" he asks,
his voice smooth and devoid of all emotion. It's his favorite tactic, giving no indication as to his mood. It's useless to search his eyes or his face for any feeling, to try to read him as I would any other person. He's too skilled for that. I answer simply, head held high. "Winning Piedmont for us." "Us." Maven hmms deep in his throat, before settling back for the long journey.
"Very well," he says, and speaks no more.
8. Mare. The Montfort escort leads us toward a palatial compound set high on a ridge overlooking the central valley, where the rest of Ascendant clings to the slopes. Everywhere, dark green banners drift in the sweet evening breeze, bearing the mark of the white triangle. A mountain, I realize, feeling silly for not having figured out their symbol sooner. Their uniforms have the same marking. My own clothes are plain, not even a uniform, just items cobbled together from stores in both Corvium and Piedmont, probably owned by a silver, judging by the fine make of the jacket, pants, boots, and shirt. Farley tromps along in her version of a uniform, with Clara swaddled on her hip. She wears red all over, with three metal squares at her collar, the mark of a command general. The silvers behind us are more flashy, and I expect nothing less from their kind. They cut a rainbow of vibrant, sharp colors against the white walkways of Ascendant that wind through the city. Cal is difficult to ignore in his burning red cloak, but I certainly try. He walks with Evangeline, and I half expect her to shove him off one of the more treacherous terraces or stairways. I keep close to my father's side, listening to him breathe. The steps of Ascendant are many, and he is an old man with a regrown leg, not to mention his repaired lung. The thin air can't be helping either. He works hard not to stumble, his red face the only hint of how much effort this takes. Mom flanks him on the left, sharing my thoughts. Her hands trail behind him, fingers splayed to help him if he falters. I would call for some kind of aid, a strong arm maybe, or even just Bree and Tramie, if Dad asked. But I know he won't. He forges ahead, touching my arm once or twice, grateful for my presence, and equally grateful for my restraint. The steps level eventually, carrying us through an archway carved to look like tree trunks and leaves. We pass through into a central plaza, its stonework a checkered spiral of hewn green granite and milky limestone. Pines of every kind line the arches bounding the place, some of them tall as towers and just as thick. I'm struck by the overpowering swell of birdsong chittering against the purpled sky. Behind me, Killorn lets loose a low whistle. He stares through the trees to a long, pillared building set into and up the cresting slope. It's a strange mix of tumbled stone, like the bottom of a riverbed, with lacquered timber and marble detail. Balconies dot its many wings, some bursting with wildflowers. All of them face into the valley to watch over Ascendant. This is the Premier's house. I'm certain of it. A palace in all but name. It makes me uneasy, while the rest of my family is rightfully dazzled. I've had enough of palaces to know I shouldn't trust what lingers behind sculpted beauty and gleaming windows. There are no walls around the palace, and no gates. There don't seem to be any surrounding ascendant either, or at least not the kind I can see. I get the feeling the geography of this city, this country, is its own kind of boundary. Montfort is strong enough not to need walls, or stupid enough not to build them. Judging by Davidson, I doubt the latter very much. Farley must be thinking the same thing. Her eyes pass over the arches, the pines, the palace, noting each one with focused precision. Then she looks back at the Silvers as they troop in after us, all of them trying not to seem impressed by Davidson's home. The Premier only waves us forward, deeper and deeper, into the heart of his country. As in Piedmont, the Barrow family is given much nicer living quarters than we're used to. The apartments within Davidson's home are vast, large enough to give each of us our own bedroom. Killorn and Gisa busy themselves with exploring, poking around the various rooms. Bree is less inclined to move, taking over one of the velvet couches in the long salon. I can hear him snoring now, from where I stand on our terrace. This is temporary, until more permanent lodging can be procured in the city. Everyone leaves me alone, either unknowingly or on purpose. I don't mind either way. Ascendant glitters below, a constellation on the mountainside. I can feel the electricity in it, distant and constant, winking in the many lights. It all looks like a reflection of the sky above. The stars seem impossibly clear here, close enough to touch. I breathe deep, sucking in the wild freshness of the mountains. This is a good place to leave them, the best place I could ask for. Along the balcony edge, flowers bloom from pots and boxes in all colors. The ones before me are purple and strangely shaped, with odd petals like a tail. They call them elephant flowers. Tramie sidles next to me, planting an elbow on the railing. He leans out to stare at the city below. Despite the season, a deep chill settles with the night. I must be shivering, because he offers a shawl with one hand. As I take it, wrapping the knitted fabric around my shoulders, he furrows his brow. I don't know what elephant means. The word rings a distant bell, but I shake my head and shrug. Neither do I. It could be an animal, I think. Julian would know. I speak his name without thinking, and I almost wince. A twinge of pain snaps in my chest. You can ask him tonight at dinner, my brother says, thoughtful as he runs a hand through his scratchy beard. I shrug again, trying to brush off all mention of Julian Jacos. You need to shave, Tramie, I snicker. Inhaling the sweet air again, I turn back to the city lights. And ask Julian yourself at dinner tonight. No. Something in his voice gives me pause, a low tremor of resolve, boldness. Tramie isn't the kind to refuse any of us. He's too used to following Bree around or smoothing over family troubles. He is a peacemaker, far from the kind to plant his feet and dig in. I glance up at him, expecting an explanation. He clenches his jaw, dark brown eyes boring into mine. He has Mom's eyes, like I do. It's no place for us. Us. His meaning is clear. This is as far as we go. The Barrows aren't politicians or warriors. They have no reason to share the spotlight or the danger I live with. But the prospect of standing alone, without them, the fear is endless and selfish and sudden. It can be, I say too quickly, taking his wrist. Tramie quickly covers my hand with his own. It should be your place, all of you. You're my family. A door creaks open onto the terrace, then shuts behind Gisa and Killorn. My sister surveys us, eyes shining.
How many people have power they shouldn't simply because their family gives it to them? She asks. She means the Silvers, the royals and the nobles who hand power to their children, no matter how unsuited they might be. The obsession with blood, with dynasty, is the reason Maven is on the throne in the first place. A twisted boy king ruling a country when he can't even rule his own mind. That's different, I mutter back, though my retort is half-hearted. You're not like them. Geesa reaches out to me, adjusting my shawl. She dotes on me the way a big sister should, even though I'm years older. The flower is still tucked behind her ear, pale as dawn. Slowly, I touch the petals, then run a lock of her hair through my fingers. The flower suits her. Will Montfort? Like Traymi said, she replies, your meetings, your councils, the war you're fighting, that's no place for us, and we don't want it to be. Geesa stares back at me, eye to eye. We're the same height for now, but I hope she keeps growing. She doesn't deserve to see the world the way I do. Okay, I breathe, pulling her close. Okay. They agree, she mumbles against me. Mom. And even Dad. Something in me releases, letting go of a great weight. But is it an anchor pulling me down, or an anchor keeping me steady? It could be both in equal measure. Without my parents or siblings hanging in the balance, who will I become? Who I must. With my head tucked on Geesa's shoulder, it's hard not to look at Killorn standing behind her. His face is dark, a storm cloud, as he watches us both. We lock eyes when he feels my gaze, and I see determination in him. He joined the Scarlet Guard long ago, and he won't take the opportunity to break that pledge. Not even to stay here, in safety, with the only family he knows. Now, Geesa says, pulling back, let's get you ready for this mess of a dinner party. Months of life on rebel bases has only sharpened my sister's keen eye for color, fabric, and fashion. Somehow she scares up a few different outfits from the palace to choose from, all of them relaxed but formal in a range of styles. None of them the gemmed monstrosities the Norton Silvers wear, of course, but still suitable for a table of kings and leaders. I have to admit, I like dressing up in this way, running my fingers over cotton or silk, deciding how to wear my hair. It's a good distraction. And necessary. Tiberius will certainly be sitting at the table with me, glowering in his crimson clothes, pouting because I held to my principles while he spit on them. Let him see exactly what he turned his back on and who. I get a sick but satisfying pleasure from the thought. Though Geesa favors the more complex outfits for me, we eventually settle on a dress both of us like. Simple, a deep plum red, long-sleeved with a trailing skirt. No jewelry but my earrings. Pink for Bree, red for Traymi, purple for Shade, green for Killorn. The final red stone, scarlet as fresh blood, is tucked away in my things. I won't wear the earring Tiberius gave me, but I can't throw it away either. It sits undisturbed, but not forgotten. Geesa quickly sews some gold braid, an intricate piece of already made embroidery, to the cuff of each sleeve. I don't know where she swiped a sewing kit from, or if Davidson's staff knew to leave her one. Her nimble fingers are equally skilled at fixing my hair, twisting my mud-brown locks into something like a crown. It hides my gray ends nicely, even though they've spread so much. The strain of the days has certainly taken its toll on me, something I don't miss in the mirror. I look washed out, sunken, my eyes circled by bruise-like shadows. I have scars of every kind, from Maven's brand, from wounds not properly healed, from my own lightning. But I am not a ruin. Not yet. The Premier's palace is vast, but the layout is simple enough, and it takes little time for me to descend to the ground floor, where the public rooms are.
Eventually, I can just follow the smell of food, letting it lead me through room after room of grand salons and galleries. I pass a dining area the size of a ballroom, dominated by a table big enough for 40, as well as a massive stone fireplace. But the table is bare, and no flame crackles in the grate.
Miss Barrow, isn't it?
I turn to the kindly voice, finding an even kinder face. A man beckons from one of the many arched doorways, leading out onto another terrace. He is perfectly bald, with midnight skin, almost purple in hue, and his smile flashes like a white crescent above an even whiter silk suit.
Yes, I reply evenly. He grins wider. Very good. We'll be eating out here, under the stars. I thought it best to do so on your first visit.
The man gestures and I follow, crossing the grand dining room to meet him. With smooth motions, he takes my arm, locking his elbow with mine as he leads me out into the cool night air. The smell of food intensifies, making my mouth water.
So tense, he chuckles, moving his arm a little to contrast my own tight muscles.
His air is easy, so much so that I want to mistrust him.
I'm Carmadon, and I cooked the dinner, so if you have any complaints, keep them to yourself.
I bite my lip, trying to hide a smirk. I'll do my best. He only taps his nose in reply. The spider veins in his eyes are gray, branching across white. His blood is silver. I swallow around a sudden lump in my throat.
May I ask what ability you possess, Carmadon?
His response is a thin smile.
Is it not obvious?
He gestures to the many plants and flowers, both on the terrace and dangling from the many balconies and windows.
I am but a humble green warden, Miss Barrow.
For the sake of appearance, I force a smile of my own. Humble. I've seen corpses with roots curling from their eyes and mouths. There is no such thing as a humble silver, or a harmless one. They all have the ability to kill. But then, I suppose, so do we. So does every human on Earth. We walk across the terrace, toward the smell and soft lights, and the low murmur of stilted conversation. This part of the palace juts out over the ridge, allowing an unobstructed view over the pines, the valley, and the snowy peaks in the distance. They seem to glow under the light of a rising moon. I try not to look eager or interested or even angry, nothing to hint at my emotions. Still, I feel my heart jump, adrenaline pumping, at the sight of Tiberius's familiar silhouette. Again, he stares out at the landscape, unable to face anyone else around him. I feel my lip curl in distaste. Since when are you a coward, Tiberius Calore? Farley paces back and forth some yards away, still wearing her command uniform. Her hair has been freshly washed, and it gleams beneath the lamps strung over the terrace table. She gives me a nod before moving to sit. Evangeline and Annabelle are already in their chairs, on either side of one end of the table. They must intend to flank Cal and trumpet their importance at his right and left. While Annabelle seems comfortable in her gown from earlier, the heavy red and orange silk, Evangeline nuzzles into a collar of smooth black fox fur. She watches me as I approach the table, eyes glittering like two devious stars. When I sit, taking my place diagonal from her, as far as possible from the exiled prince, her lips twist into what could be a smile. Carmadon doesn't seem to notice or care that his dinner guests are hell-bent on hating one another. He sits gracefully in the chair across from mine, at the right hand of where I assume Davidson will be. A servant springs from the shadows to fill his intricately etched wine glass. I watch with narrowed eyes. The servant has red blood, judging by the flush in her cheeks. She is neither old nor young, but she smiles as she works. I've never seen a red servant smile like that, unless commanded.
They're paid, and paid fairly, Farley says, sitting down beside our host. I've already checked.
Carmadon swirls the wine in his glass,
Poke and prod at whatever you like, General Farley. Check behind the curtains for all I care. There are no slaves in my house, he says, his voice taking on a stern edge. We haven't been properly introduced, I say, feeling more rude than usual. Your name is Carmadon, but of course, excuse my manners, Miss Barrow. Premier Davidson is my husband, and he is currently very late. I would apologize if the dinner goes cold waiting for him. He waves a hand at the table of food nearby, holding our first course. But his punctuality is neither my fault nor my problem. His words are harsh, but his manner friendly and open. If Davidson is difficult to read, his husband is an open book. And so is Evangeline right now. She stares at the man with such naked envy, I think she might turn green. And no wonder. Their lives, a marriage such as this, are impossible in our country. Forbidden, considered a waste of silver blood. But not here. I fold my hands in my lap, trying not to fidget despite the nervous energy settling over the table. Annabelle has not spoken either because she disapproves of Carmadon or because she disapproves of eating alongside Reds. It could be both. Farley barely nods her head in thanks when Carmadon fills her glass with rich, almost black wine. She drinks deep. I stick to ice water, speckled with slices of bright lemon. The last thing I need is a spinning head and blurred thoughts with Tiberius Calore anywhere nearby. I glance at him as he enters, running my eyes over his familiar shoulders, thrown wide beneath the edges of a red cape. It seems more like flame in the warm lights of the terrace. When he turns around, I drop my gaze. I can only listen as he approaches, his presence heavy on the air. A wrought iron chair scrapes against the stone terrace, its movement agonizingly slow and deliberate. I almost jolt when I realize exactly where he has decided to sit. His arm brushes mine, just for a second, and his warmth settles around me. I curse the familiar comfort of it, especially against the mountain chill. Finally, I dare to look up, only to find Carmadon with his head tilted, chin resting on one fist. He seems infinitely amused. At his side, Farley looks more inclined to vomit, and I don't have to see Annabelle's face to know she's scowling. I lock my hands together beneath the tabletop, knitting my fingers so tightly my knuckles turn white, not with fear, but with anger. Next to me, Tiberius leans, one elbow on the arm of the chair closest to me. He could whisper in my ear if he wanted. I grip my teeth, resisting the instinct to spit. Across the table, Evangeline almost purrs to herself. She runs a hand through her furs, her decorative claws gleaming. How many courses does this meal have, my Lord Carmadon? Davidson's husband doesn't look away from me, and his lips twitch in what could be a smirk. Six? With a scowl, Farley knocks back the rest of her wine. Grinning, Carmadon gestures to the servants in the shadows. Dane and your Lord Julian can catch up, he says, calling for the first course with a flick of his fingers. I hope you enjoy. We've taken great care to prepare some Montfort delicacies. The service is smooth and quick, just as efficient but less formal than I've seen in the palaces of silver kings. Carmadon presides as small plates of elegant bone china are laid out in front of us. I look down at a pink slice of fish the size of my thumb, topped with some kind of creamy cheese and asparagus. Fresh-caught salmon from the Kalem River in the west, Carmadon explains, before popping the entire thing in his mouth. Farley quickly follows suit. The Kalem drains to the western coast, into the ocean. In my head, I try to picture what he's talking about. But my knowledge of his lands is poor, at best. There's another ocean, yes, bordering the western edge of the continent, but that's all I can grasp right now. My Uncle Julian will be eager to learn more of your country, Tiberius replies. He speaks slowly, with conviction. It ages him a decade.
I suspect his questions are what delay both him and the Premier now.
Perhaps my Dane does delight in his library.
And so would Julian. I wonder if the Premier is trying to form ties of his own. Perhaps make an ally of a friendly Norton Silver. Or maybe Davidson is just enjoying time with another scholar, eager to share word of his country. After the salmon comes a hot vegetable soup, steaming in the chilly air, and then a salad of fresh greens and wild huckleberry, grown on this very mountain. Carmadon doesn't seem to mind that no one else is speaking. He fills the silence with his own chatter, pleasantly comfortable as he details every bit of the meal he prepared. The particulars of a salad dressing, the best time to pick berries, how long the vegetables must cook, the size of his personal garden, and so on. I doubt Evangeline, Tiberius, or Annabelle has ever cooked a day in their life, and I wonder if Farley's ever eaten anything that wasn't stolen or rationed. I do my best to seem polite, although I have little to say, especially with Tiberius so close, inhaling everything on his plate. I glance at him here and there, hoarding brief flashes of his face, his jaw clenched, his throat working. He never shaved so closely before. If I didn't have my pride or conviction, I might run my knuckles over his cheek, close against smooth skin. This time, he catches my eye before I can look away. My instinct is to blink, break the stare, turn back to my plate, or maybe even excuse myself from the table, but I hold my ground. If the would-be king wants to put me on edge, knock me back on my heels, then fine. I can do that, too. I set my shoulders, straighten my spine, and most important of all, remember to breathe. Tiberius is just one more silver who will leave my people enslaved, no matter what he preaches. He is an obstacle and a shield. A delicate balance must be kept. He blinks first, returning to his food. I do the same. It burns to be near him, so close to a person I used to trust, a body I know so well. One choice, one word, and things would be so different. This dinner would be spent trading glances, communicating in our way about Evangeline or Annabelle or Davidson's absence. Or they wouldn't be here at all. It would be us on this terrace, under the stars, surrounded by a new kind of country. An imperfect one, maybe, but a goal just the same. Carmadon is silver. His husband, a red new blood. The servants are not slaves. I've seen little of Montfort, but enough to know this place might be different. And we could be different in it. If only he would let us. Tiberius still wears no crown, but I see it on him just the same. In his shoulders, in his eyes, in his slow, firm manner. He is a king as much as anyone can be. To the blood, to the bone. When the servants clear the salad plates, Carmadon glances at the door, as if expecting Davidson to join us. He frowns a little when no one appears but gestures for the next course anyway. This is a particular Montfortan treat, he says with a pasted smile. A plate slides onto the table in front of me. It looks like a particularly thick and juicy cut of steak, flanked by golden fried potatoes and mushrooms, onions, and leafy greens, cooked in sauce. In a word, delicious.
Steak? Annabelle asks, leaning forward with an unkind smile. I promise, my lord Carmadon, we do have steak in our country. But our host ticks one dark finger. It incenses the old queen as much as his disregard for titles does. On the contrary, you have cattle. This is bison. What is bison? I ask, eager to try it for myself. His knife scrapes the plate as he slices a cut. A different species, albeit close in relation to the cattle you know,
bigger by far, better in taste, much stronger and heartier, with horns and shaggy coats, and enough muscle to knock over a transport if they so choose. Most here are wild, though some farms exist. They roam the Paradise Valley, the hills, and the plains as well. They thrive even in winters that could kill man or beast. You'd never look a live bison in the face and call her cattle. That, I can assure you. I watch, fascinated, as his blade cuts through such strange meat. Red juice bleeds across his meal, staining the white china. An interesting thing, the bison and the cow. So similar, two branches of the same tree, though entirely different from one another. And separate as they are, divided as the two species can be, they can live alongside each other just fine, mingle their herds. They can even breed. Next to me, Tiberius coughs, almost choking on a piece of food. My cheeks flame hot. Evangeline laughs into her hand. Farley finishes the bottle of wine. Have I said something impertinent? Carmadon glances between us, his black eyes dancing. He knows exactly what he said and what it means. Annabelle cuts in before anyone else can, under the guise of easing her grandson's embarrassment. She surveys the palace over the lip of her glass. Your husband's lateness is quite rude, my lord. The smiling Carmadon doesn't miss a beat. I agree with you. I'll make sure his punishment is swift. The bison is lean, and Carmadon is right. Better than beef. I don't bother with manners, as Carmadon seems quite at ease eating potatoes with his hands. It only takes a minute for me to devour half the bison steak and all the browned onions. I'm so focused on cleaning my plate with my fork, scraping together the perfect bite, that I barely notice the door open again behind us. Apologies, of course, Davidson says, his pace even but quick, as he walks toward the table. Julian trails him closely. Side by side, I'm struck by how similar Julian and Davidson look. In air, not appearance. They both have a hunger about them, the intellectual kind. Otherwise, they could not be more different. Julian is too slim, his graying hair thinning and wispy, his eyes watery and brown. Davidson is a picture of health, his gray hair neatly cut and gleaming, and despite his age, he is all lean muscle. What have we missed? He asks, taking the seat beside his husband. With some awkward glances, Julian surveys the table and claims the only open seat, the one meant for Tiberius, if Tiberius weren't so hell-bent on annoying me. Carmadon sniffs. Discussion of the menu, the breeding habits of bison, and your lack of punctuality. The premier's laugh is open, honest. He either feels no need to perform, or he performs perfectly in his own home.
Normal dinner conversation, then.
At the far end of the table, Julian leans forward, looking sheepish.
The fault is mine, I'm afraid.
The library? His nephew offers with a knowing grin.
We heard.
My heart twists at the warmth in Tiberius's voice. He loves his uncle, and any reminder of the person Tiberius is beneath his bad choices makes me ache. A corner of Julian's mouth lifts.
I'm the predictable kind, aren't I?
I prefer predictable, I mutter, but loud enough for the table to hear. Farley smirks at her plate, and Tiberius scowls, turning to me with a quick, even snap of his neck. His mouth opens, as if he's about to say something rash and stupid. His grandmother speaks before he can, eager to protect him from himself.
And what makes this library so interesting?
She asks, her disdain evident.
I can't help myself.
Probably the books.
Farley barks out a laugh, with little regard,
while Julian tries to hide a smirk in his napkin. The rest are more demure, but Tiberius's low chuckle stops me cold. I glance at him to see him smiling, eyes crinkled at the corners as he looks down at me. I realize that, for a moment, he has forgotten where we are and who we are. His laughter dies in an instant, his face falling back into a more neutral expression. Ah, yes, Julian pushes on, if only to distract us all. The volumes are quite extensive, not just regarding science, but history as well. I'm afraid we lost track of ourselves. He bobs his head and samples the wine. Then he tips his glass toward Davidson. Or the premier obliged me, at least. Davidson raises his glass in reply. A watch ticks on his wrist. Always happy to share books. Knowledge is a rising tide. Lifts all boats, as it were. You should visit the Vaults of Vale, Carmadon puts in. Or even Horn Mountain. We do not intend to be here long enough for sightseeing, Annabelle says with a sniff. Slowly, she lays her silverware on her plate of half-eaten food, indicating how supremely finished she is with all this. In her furs, Evangeline lifts her head. Like a cat, she surveys the old queen, weighing something. I agree, she says. The sooner we're able to return, the better. Return to someone, she means. Well, that isn't up to us, is it? Excuse me, Farley adds as she leans across the table. Annabelle's eyes almost bug out of her head as she watches a red rebel grab her abandoned plate and scrape the leftovers onto her own. With sure hands, Farley slices up the extra cut of bison, the knife dancing through meat. I've seen her do worse to human flesh. It's up to the Montfort government, she says, and whether or not they decide to give us more soldiers. Eh, Premier? Indeed, Davidson says. Wars cannot be won on familiar faces alone, no matter how bright the flag, how high the standard. His gaze flickers from Tiberius to me. What he means is clear. We need armies. Tiberius nods. And we'll get them. If not from Montfort, then from anywhere we can. The high houses of Norta can be swayed. How Samos tried. Evangeline gestures for more wine with a lazy, familiar twist of her fingers. We aligned who we could, but the rest? I wouldn't rely on them. Tiberius blanches. You think they'll stay loyal to Maven? When they have you to choose? The Samos princess scoffs, cutting him off with an imperious glare. My dear Tiberius, they could have chosen you months ago, but in the eyes of many, you're still a traitor. Across from me, Farley scowls. Are your nobles so stupid as to still think Tiberius killed his own father? I shake my head, knife in hand. She means because he's with us, allied to Reds. The blade slices through the rest of the meat on my plate. I cut with vicious force, tasting bitterness in my mouth. Trying so desperately to find balance between our peoples. That is what I hope to do, Tiberius says, his voice oddly soft. I pull my gaze away from the cooked flesh to stare at him again. His eyes meet mine, wide and disgustingly gentle. I harden myself to his charms. You have an interesting way of showing it, I sneer. Annabelle is quick, barking a retort. Enough, both of you! My jaw tightens, and I look past Tiberius to his grandmother, now glaring at me. I meet her gaze with equal fire. This is Maven's strength, one of his many strengths, I say. He divides so easily, without even trying. He does it to his enemies and to his allies. At the head of the table, Davidson steeples his fingers. He surveys me over his knuckles, unblinking in his focus. Go on. Like Evangeline said,
There are noble families who will never abandon him because he won't change the way things are, and he's good at ruling, winning over his subjects while keeping the nobles satiated. Ending the Lakelander War earned him a great deal of respect among the people, I point out, remembering how even Reds cheered him when he toured the countryside. It still turns my stomach. He plays on that love, just as he plays on fear. When I was his prisoner, he was careful to keep many children in court, heirs to different houses, hostages in all but name. It's an easy way to control a person, seizing what they hold most dear. I know that firsthand. And on top of everything else, I add, swallowing around the lump in my throat. There is no predicting Maven Kalor. His mother still whispers in his head, pulling his strings, even though she lies dead and cold. A low current of heat ripples at my side. Tiberius stares at the tabletop, looking as if he might burn a hole through his plate. His cheeks are drained of color now, pale as bone. With her eyes still on me, watching me devour the last bites of steak, Annabelle curls her lip. "Prince Bracken in Piedmont is under our control," she says. "He will give us whatever we need." Bracken, another one of Montfort's schemes. The ruling prince of Piedmont is under our thumb, as long as Montfort still holds his son and daughter captive. I wonder where they are, who they are. Are they young? Are they just children? Are they innocent in all this? The temperature begins to rise, a small but steady increase. Next to me, Tiberius tightens. He fixes his grandmother with a firm stare.
"I don't want soldiers who haven't agreed to fight for me, especially Bracken Silvers. They can't be trusted. Neither can he."
"We have his children," Farley says. "That should be enough."
"Montfort has his children," Tiberius replies, his voice deepening.
Before, on the base, it was easy to ignore the price someone paid. The evil's done for good reasons. I look to Davidson, who glances at his watch. "This is war," he said once, trying to justify what must be done. "If they were returned, could we convince Piedmont to stand aside?" I ask. "Remain neutral?" The Premier turns his empty wine glass around in his hands, letting the many facets catch the soft light of lanterns. I think I see regret in him.
"I doubt that very much."
"Are they here?"
Annabelle asks the question with a calm so forced I almost expect her to pop a vein in her neck.
"Bracken's children?"
Davidson doesn't reply, moving only to refill his glass. The old queen tips a finger, her eyes shining.
"Ah, they are."
Her grin spreads.
"Good leverage. We can bargain for more of Bracken's soldiers, an entire army, if we wish."
I look at the napkin in my lap, stained with fingerprints of grease and bits of lipstick wiped away. "They could be in this palace, looking down at us right now. Children at the window, trapped behind a locked door. Are they strong enough to require silent guards, or even the torture of chains like the ones I used to wear? I know what that kind of prison is like. Under the table, I touch both my wrists, feeling the empty skin there. Flesh instead of manacles, electricity instead of silence. Tiberius suddenly slams a closed fist on the table, making the plates and glassware jump. I jolt too, surprised.
"We will do no such thing," he snarls. "The resources are enough."
His grandmother scowls at him, deepening the lines of her face.
"You need bodies to win wars, Tiberius."
"The discussion of Bracken is over,"
is all he says in reply. With finality, he cuts the last piece of steak in two, sawing with his knife. Annabelle sneers, showing teeth, but says nothing. He is her grandson, but also a king by her own declaration. She has long passed the line of what is proper debate with a sovereign.
"So we must beg tomorrow," I mumble. "It's the only choice left."
Frustrated, I signal for a glass of wine of my own
and don't waste time gulping it down. The sweet red soothes enough that I can almost ignore the feel of eyes on my face. Bronze eyes.
I suppose you could call it that,
Davidson says, his gaze far away. He looks down, first at his watch again, then sidelong to Carmadon. Their glance speaks volumes I cannot fathom. It makes me envious, and again I find myself wishing things were different.
What chance do we have?
Tiberius is blunt, forceful, and direct. All the things he's been taught a king should be.
For a full deployment of every soldier in our armies?
Davidson shakes his head.
No chance at all. We have borders of our own to guard, but half? A bit more?
I could see the scales tipping in our favor.
If.
If. I hate that word. I brace myself in my seat, suddenly more on edge than usual. I feel like the terrace might crumble beneath me and send us all plunging into the valley. Farley's face mirrors my fear. She keeps her knife in hand, wary of our ally.
If what?
The bells sound before Davidson can answer, and while the rest of us jump, startled by the noise, he doesn't move. He's used to it. Or he expected it. This isn't a chime to mark the hours on a clock. These bells ring deep and low, their voices trembling down the mountainside, echoing across Ascendant, calling to other bells throughout the city. The din spreads like a wave, running down this slope and back up the other. Lights spread with the noise, bright, harsh lights, floodlights, security lights. The alarm that follows is mechanical, whining. It shatters the calm mountain valley with its wail. Tiberius jumps to his feet, cloak swirling around his shoulders. He frees one hand, fingers wide, the flamemaker bracelet glinting beneath his sleeve. If he calls to fire, it will come. Evangeline and Annabelle do the same, both of them lethal. Neither looks afraid, only determined to protect themselves. I feel the lightning in me rise the same way, and my thoughts fly to my family in the palace behind us. Not safe, not even here. But we have no time for one more of my heartbreaks. Farley stands too, leaning hard on her hands. She glares at Davidson.
If what?
She snaps again, yelling over the alarm. He looks up at her, oddly serene among the chaos. Soldiers replace servants in the shadows, flanking our table. I tense, fists clenching at my sides.
If Montfort will fight for you, the Premier says, turning his eyes on Tiberius. You must also fight for us.
Carmadon doesn't seem startled by the bells. He only glances toward the palace before sighing in what could be annoyance.
Raiders, he scowls.
Every single time I try to throw a dinner party.
That's hardly true.
Davidson cracks a grin, though he never breaks his gaze. His eyes remain on Tiberius, a challenge as much as anything.
Well, it feels true, says Carmadon, pouting.
As security lights blaze all around us, Davidson's gaze flames gold. Tiberius's burns red.
They call you the Flame of the North, Your Majesty.
Show us fire. Then, the Premier looks at me,
and show us storm.
9. Mare. I said no more surprises, I hiss to Davidson, following close on his heels as he leads us through his palace. Farley marches next to him, her hand resting on the pistol at her hip, as if she expects raiders to start popping out of the closets. The silver members of our party are just as on edge. Annabelle keeps their ranks tight. She repeatedly slows Tiberius, nudging him back behind a protective wall of loyal guards from House Larilan. Evangeline is better at hiding her fear, her face the usual twist between sneer and smirk. She has two escorts of her own, Samos cousins, I think. Her dress changes quickly, reforming into scaly armor as we weave through the halls of the Montfort Palace. The Premier looks over his shoulder when I speak and surveys me with a withering glance. The bells and alarm echo strangely in the hall, dancing around his words.
Mayor, I can hardly control the whims of raiders, and I do not schedule their attacks, frequent as they may be.
I hold his gaze and quicken my pace, hot anger pulsing through my veins.
You don't?
It wouldn't surprise me. I've seen kings do worse to their own people in exchange for power. Davidson turns steely and presses his lips into a grim line. A sudden flush spreads across his broad cheekbones. His voice drops to a whisper.
We had warning. Yes, we knew they were coming. And we had enough lead time to make sure the outskirts were protected. But I resent the implication that I would spill the blood of my own people, risk their lives. For what? Dramatic effect? He hisses, his voice deadly as a knife edge.
Yes, this presents an opportunity for the Scarlet Guard and for Kalor to uphold their ends of the bargain and to prove something before we go to my government and beg. But it is not a trade I'm happy to make. He snaps.
I'd much rather be sitting out on the terrace, getting pleasantly drunk with my husband, watching overpowered children sneer at each other, than do this.
I feel scolded, but also relieved. Davidson glares at me, fire burning in his golden eyes. He's usually so serene, unflappable, impossible to discern. His strength lies not just in ability or charisma, but in a well-practiced calm that few can see beyond. Not now. Merely the suggestion of any betrayal, however small, to his country, has him incensed. I understand that kind of loyalty. I respect it. I can even almost trust it.
So, what are we going to do? I ask, satisfied for the moment.
The Premier slows, then halts, turning his back to the wall, so he can see all of us. It stops everyone short, crowding the wide passageway with waiting reds and silvers. Even Queen Annabel looks on Davidson with grave attention.
Our patrols reported raiders crossing the border an hour ago, he says. They usually head for the towns down on the plain or to the city itself.
I think about my parents, my siblings in Killorn, either sleeping through the noise or questioning it. I don't want to fight, not if it means leaving them behind and in danger. Farley catches my eye, and I see the same fear in her. Clara is upstairs, too, tucked into a crib.
Davidson does his best to assuage us.
The alarms are cautionary, and our citizens know it, he says. Ascendant is well defended from attack. The mountains alone provide enough protection to keep most assaults to the plains or low on the eastern slopes. They would have to climb into our own teeth to get within striking distance of the city.
Are the raiders particularly stupid, then?
Farley asks, trying to bluster away her concern. She doesn't take her hand off her gun.
A corner of Davidson's mouth lifts, and I think I hear Carmadon cough yes into his hand.
No, the Premier replies. But they are very keen on optics. Attacking the Montfort capital is somewhat of a habit for them. It wins favor among their own, as well as the prairie lords.
Tiberius lifts his chin. He shifts slowly, edging in front of one of his guards. I can tell by the tightness in his shoulders that he hates being hemmed in like that.
Hates being anywhere but the front line. It isn't in Tiberius Kalor to ask another to do what he won't, to face danger if he doesn't.
And who are they, exactly? He asks.
You've all asked about silvers in Montfort, Davidson says, his voice loud enough to carry over the warning alarms. You wonder how they live this way, how we changed things decades ago. Some silvers agreed to freedom, to democracy. Many, I should say.
Most. He clenches his jaw. They saw what the world should be like, or they saw the world beyond and decided it was better to stay, easier to adjust.
His eyes land on Evangeline, and for some reason she flushes under his scrutiny, almost hiding her face.
Some did not. Old silvers, royals,
nobles who could not stand our new country. They fled or fought their way to the borders, north, south, west. To the east, in the empty hills between our mountains and prairie, they formed bands, attempts at their own lands and lordships, always fighting, gnawing at each other and us. They live as leeches, feeding on what they find. They do not grow anything, they do not build. They have little holding them together but anger and dying pride. They attack transports, farms, cities, in both Prairie and Montfort. They focus on red towns and villages mostly, on those who cannot defend against silver onslaught. They move, they strike, they move again. And so we call them the raiders. Carmadon tisks loudly. He runs a hand over his gleaming purple-black skull. So far to fall for my silver kin, for nothing more than pride, and for what they think is power. Davidson adds. His eyes land on Tiberius. The exiled prince straightens, setting his jaw. For what they think they deserve. They would rather lose everything than live beneath people they think are lesser. Idiots, I curse. History is marred with people like that, Julian offers, resistant to change. But they make those willing to change all the more heroic, don't they? I reply, letting the words land as they should. Tiberius doesn't take the bait. Where will they strike? He says, never moving his eyes from Davidson's face. The premier grins darkly. We've received word from one of the towns down on the plain. Raiders are close, he says. Your Majesty, I believe I may get to show you the Hawk Way after all. No palace is complete without an armory. Davidson's guards are already there, suiting up throughout the long room stocked with weaponry and gear. They don't pull on the green coveralls, the uniforms I've become accustomed to, but tight black suits and high boots, good for defending against a night raid. They remind me of what I used to wear in training, my purple and silver striped outfit to mark me as a child of House Titanos. A silver through and through. A lie. At the door, Annabelle puts a hand on Cal's arm. She pleads with her eyes, but he moves past her, firmly but gently pushing her away. Her fingers trail along the edge of his red cape, letting the black brocade run through her fingers as he escapes her grasp.
I need to do this, I hear him murmur. He's right. I need to fight for them if they'll fight for me.
No one else speaks, and the silence falls thick as a low cloud. All I hear is the shuffle of clothing. My dress puddles around my ankles as I quickly pull the suit up over my underclothes. As I move, I shift, and my eyes lock on familiar muscles. Tiberius faces away from me, too, his shirt discarded, the suit tight around his waist. I trace the length of his spine, noting the few scars along otherwise smooth and sculpted skin. They're old, older than mine. One in training, in a palace, and on a war front that no longer exists. Even though the touch of a healer could erase them quickly, he keeps them, collecting scars as another would medals or badges. Will he earn more scars today? Will Davidson keep his promise? Part of me wonders if this is a trap for the true Kalor King. An easy assassination disguised as a real threat. But even if Davidson lied about not harming Tiberius, he's not an idiot. Removing the older Kalor would only weaken us, destroying a vital shield between Montfort and the Scarlet Guard and Maven. I keep staring, unable to stop myself. The scars might be old, but not the almost purple, bruise-like mark where his neck meets his shoulder. That's new, only a few days old. That's mine, I think, gulping around a memory both close and infinitely far away. Someone bumps my shoulder, jolting me out of the quicksand that is Tiberius Kalor. Here, Farley says gruffly, a warning. She hasn't discarded her dark red uniform of command, and she stares down at me, blue eyes wide. Let me. Her fingers zip up the back of my suit with speed,
tightening the ensemble around my frame. I shuffle a little, adjusting the thick woven fabric of my two long sleeves, anything to keep my attention away from the exiled prince currently shoving his arms into his own suit.
"Nothing in your size, Barrow?"
Titan's deep drawl offers a well-needed distraction. He leans up alongside us, back braced against the wall, with one long leg stretched out. His suit is the same as mine, albeit better fitted to his trim form. No lightning insignia, no markings, no indication of how deadly a man this new blood is. With him around, I realize Davidson has no need to arrange useful accidents to remove opponents. He only needs Titan. The chilling thought is somehow a balm. This isn't a trap, at the very least. It doesn't need to be. I slide on my boots, smirking. I'll have words with the tailor when we get back. Across the room, Tiberius rolls his sleeves, exposing his flamemaker bracelet. Evangeline looks almost bored at his side, her furs tossed to the floor to reveal the full armor, covering her from fingertips to toes. She catches my glance and holds my gaze. I don't expect her to stick her neck out for anyone but Elaine Haven, and yet I feel safer with her around. She saved me twice before, and I'm still of value to her. Our agreement still stands. Tiberius must not win the throne. The room clears as we prepare, moving from the changing area to the rows and rows of arms at the back of the room. Farley weighs herself down with ammunition, putting a pistol on her other hip and a snub machine gun across her back. I assume she already has her knives tucked away. I don't take any weapons, but Titan grabs a belt, pistol and holster off the rack, shoving them toward me. No thanks, I grumble, begrudging. I don't like guns or bullets. I don't trust them, and I don't need them. I can't control either one the way I can control my lightning.
Some raiders are silence, he replies, his voice a low whip-crack. Just the thought turns my insides. I know the feel of silent stone all too well. It isn't a sensation I would like to bear again, not for any reason.
Without warning, Titan fastens the gun belt around my waist, his eyes and fingers quick on the buckles. The gun slides into its holster, feeling heavy and unfamiliar at my side.
If you lose your ability, he adds, it's best to have a backup.
Behind us, the temperature rises, a rippling heat that can only mean one thing. I look up just in time to watch Tiberius shoulder by, keeping his distance, furiously intent on staring at the floor as he goes, trying to ignore me. He might as well wear a sign around his neck.
Careful with those hands, Titan. He growls over his shoulder. She bites.
Titan just chuckles darkly. He doesn't need to respond and doesn't attempt to. It only incenses Tiberius further. For once, I don't care about the scarlet flush heating my cheeks. I step away from Titan, who was still laughing. Tiberius watches me as I catch up to him, his bronze eyes alight with something more than his usual fire. Electric energy pulses through my limbs. I keep it in check, using it to fuel my resolve.
Don't be such a possessive ass, I snap, driving my elbow into his ribs as I stalk by. It's like hitting a wall. If you insist on calling yourself a king, you can at least act like one.
Behind me, he lets loose something between a snarl and a frustrated sigh. I don't respond, don't look back, and don't stop until I've followed the steady current of soldiers outside onto the central plaza, where we first arrived hours ago. Black and forest green transports crowd the stone, the vehicles fanned out evenly. Davidson waits by the lead, Carmadon at his side. They embrace quickly, touching foreheads and kissing, before Carmadon backs away. Neither of them seems bothered by the impending skirmish. This must be a common occurrence, or they're very good at masking their fear. It could be both. The palace overlooks the growing number of soldiers and shadows move on the balconies, servants and guests alike. I squint, trying to find my family among the silhouettes. Gisa's hair should stand out, but I spot Dad first. He hunches over a railing, leaning out to watch. When he sees me, he tips his head, but only a little. I want to wave, but it feels silly. And when the transports rev to life, their engines a growl across the pines, I know that calling to them is no use either. I find Farley at the lead transport, waiting alongside Davidson. She clambers inside, hoisting herself up and into the raised vehicle. These transports are different from the ones I'm used to. The wheels are much bigger, almost my height, with deep treads for the rocky, jagged mountain terrain. The rest of the body is reinforced, piped with steel, and decorated with many handholds, toeholds, and dangling straps, for obvious purpose. Titan jumps up, scrambling onto the back of the lead. He links himself to the frame alongside another Montfort soldier. The straps connect to their waists, giving them enough slack to lean, but not enough to bounce. Other soldiers, with all kinds of blood, do the same across the transports. Without their insignia, I can't tell for certain, but I assume they are the best shots, with both bullets and ability. Premier Davidson holds the door, waiting for me to join him inside the transport. Something hungry and wild drives me to do the opposite. I climb up next to Titan, tying myself in on his right. One corner of his mouth lifts, the only acknowledgement of my choice. The transport behind us is for Tiberius and Evangeline, their guards flanking the vehicle in unmistakable colors. I watch as Evangeline halts, one foot on the step up. She looks, not at me, but back at the palace. At Carmadon, waiting by the grand entrance, arms crossed, his white suit glowing in the floodlights. Annabelle stands nearby, a few feet distant, on the edge of impolite. She raises her chin when Tiberius appears, striding across the plaza with long steps. Without his colors, he seems like all the rest. A soldier, with orders to answer to. Fitting. That's who he thinks he is. Just another person under his father's command, obeying the will of someone dead. Again, we lock eyes, and something in both of us burns. Despite everything, his presence feels like safety. No matter what, he chases away any fear I have for myself. Of course, that only leaves fear for the people I love. For Farley, for my family, and still, always, for him. A settlement down on the plain is at risk, calling for aid on the other side of the mountain. There isn't time to go down the slope and wind around through the valley, so we go over it. There are roads above the palace, weaving high into the pines. We scream over the steep landscape, beneath branches so tight they obscure the stars. I lean flat to the transport, afraid of being dashed into an overhanging bough. Soon the trees are gone entirely, and the earth beneath our transports turns rocky. My head tightens, my ears popping like they do during jet takeoffs. Snow pocks the sloping ground, gathered in hollows at first, until it blankets the final peak. My exposed face goes red with cold, but the suits are special made, keeping me warm. Still, my teeth chatter, and I wonder exactly what possessed me to ride on the back of the transport rather than inside it. The tip of the mountain looms above, a white knife against a sky pinpricked with blazing stars. I lean back as far as I dare. The sight makes me feel small. My balance shifts, marking the descent. Snow sprays in our wake, then rocks and dirt, kicking up a cloud of debris to follow the transports down the eastern slope. My stomach plummets as we approach the tree line again. The plain stretches out beyond the pines, endless and dark as an ocean. I feel as if I could see across 1,000 miles, back to the Lakelands, to Norta, to Maven and whatever he has in store for us. Another hammer will fall, and soon. But where? On who? None of us can say yet. We plunge into the trees, the transport bouncing over roots and boulders. There are no roads on this side, only barely cleared paths through the arched branches. My teeth rattle with every bump, and the restraints are certainly bruising my hips.
Call to it.
Titan growls, nudging up against me so I can hear him over the roar of engines and howl of wind.
Be ready.
I nod, steeling myself. The thrum of electricity is easy to pull. I make sure not to draw from the engines around me, but on the lightning only I can summon. Purple and dangerous, it thunders under my skin. The massive pines thin, and I glimpse starlight between their needles. Not above, but beyond. Out. Forward. I shriek, pressing myself against the transport as it skids, turning a hard left onto a sudden, smooth road along the cliffside. For a terrifying moment, I think we might spin right off the mountain and plummet into the darkness below. But the vehicle holds firm, tires catching the road as one by one the other transports follow, hard drifting over the paved way.
Easy,
Titan says, eyes flickering over my body. Purple sparks are running up and down my skin, responding to my fear. They burn off harmlessly, flickering in the dark. There wasn't a better way to do that, I mutter. He barely shrugs. Hewn stone arches over the road at intervals, the structure's smooth cut, in alternating curves of marble and limestone. Each one is crowned with a pair of carved wings, the feathers etched deep into the rock to surround blazing lights illuminating the path. The Hawkway. I breathe aloud. A worthy name for the road as high as hawks and eagles fly. In the daylight, it must be astounding. The road zigzags back and forth down the almost cliff-like mountainside, precarious with sharp switchbacks. This must be the quickest way down to the plain, and also the most insane. But the transport drivers are infinitely skilled, hitting each razor-edged corner with precision. Perhaps they are all silks, or a new blood equivalent, their agility translating to the machines they drive. I try to stay vigilant as we tear down the Hawkway, on the lookout for hostile silvers hiding in the rocks and gnarled trees. Lights on the plains come into focus. The few towns Davidson mentioned dot the landscape. They seem peaceful, untouched, and vulnerable. We're rounding another switchback turn when something like a scream pierces the night. The sound of tearing metal, shredding at the seams, shrieks around us. I look up to see a transport falling, tipping over and over, knocked out of its place halfway back the line. All seems to slow down as it comes into blinding focus, my senses narrowing to the transport, spiraling in midair. The Montfort soldiers on board fight with their restraints, hoping to beat gravity. Another, a strong arm, grabs for the road edge. It slips through his fingers, the pavement cracking beneath his touch. The transport continues to fall, spinning on its axis. It can't be an accident. The trajectory is too perfect. It's going to flatten us. I barely have time to duck while my own transport lurches beneath me, our brakes squealing, trying to stop in time. Smoke burns from the tires as the brakes lock up. The road jumps when the transport smashes down, and we smash into it. Titan grabs the back of my suit, yanking me upward, while I snap my arms over my restraints, using my electricity to cut through the thick weave. We scramble forward as Tiberius and Evangeline's transport smashes into our rear, pinning us between the fallen vehicle and theirs. More screaming brakes and resounding crashes echo behind us, one after the other, a chain reaction of twisted engines and burned rubber. Only the last transports in the line, six or so, are saved from the onslaught. They're able to brake in time to save their machinery. I look back and forth, ahead and behind, not sure where to go. The fallen transport lies on its back, an overturned turtle. Davidson is already out of the lead, stumbling toward the soldiers crushed beneath the vehicle. Farley moves with him, gun ready in her hand. She drops to a knee, training her sights on the cliffs above us.
Magnetrons! Davidson roars, one hand raised for aid. He pushes out a palm, forming a clear blue shield along the deadly edge of the road.
Somehow, Evangeline is already at his side, her hands dancing. She hisses as she raises the heavy transport off the road, revealing twisted limbs and a few flattened skulls, seeping brain like popped grapes leaking juice. Davidson doesn't waste time, lurching forward to pull survivors from beneath the floating transport. Moving slowly, Evangeline lowers the transport again. With a twitch of her fingers, she rips off one of the doors, allowing those inside to tumble out. The soldiers are bloody and disoriented, but living. "Get out of the way," she snaps, waving them back from the transport. When they do, limping out of her path, she slaps her palms together in a resounding clap. The transport does as she wills, crushing itself into a dense, jagged ball the size of one of its doors. She lets it drop with a crack. Only the glass and the tires fly in every direction, beyond Evangeline's metallic control. One tire rolls down the road. An odd sight. I realize I'm standing up on my pinned transport. Evangeline turns around, her armor reflecting the starlight. Despite Titan next to me, I feel exposed, an easy target. "Get the healers up here," I shout, looking back along the line of crushed vehicles piled up beneath the arches. "And get some more light on the road." Above us, something flares, a rising beam like the sun. The work of shadows, no doubt, manipulators of light. It sends harsh light and harsher darkness dancing across us all. I squint and clench a fist, sparking some electricity of my own around my knuckles. Like Farley, I keep my eyes on the rocky ledges rising all around. If the raiders somehow have the high ground, if they're above us, then we lose a great advantage. Tiberius already knows that. "Eyes up! Sights on the cliffs!" he shouts, his back to his transport. He too has a pistol in one hand, while flames twist around the fingers of the other. Not that the soldiers need such instruction. Anyone with a gun has it raised, fingers ready on the trigger. We just need a target. But the Hawkway is oddly silent, quiet except for the occasional shout and echo as orders pass along the line. A dozen or so Montfort soldiers work their way down the zagging road, silhouettes in their black suits. They stop at each transport, using their abilities to try to pull apart the mashed vehicles. Magnetrons and strong arms, or the new blood versions of each. Evangeline and her cousins stomp by below, focusing on extricating my transport from theirs. "Can you fix it?" I call down. She just sneers as she forces the twisted metal to slither apart. "I'm a magnetron, not a mechanic," she grunts, shouldering between the wrecks. Suddenly I wish for Cameron and her tool belt, but she is far away, out of danger with her brother back in Piedmont. I bite my lip, brain buzzing. This is a blatant trap, an easy one, leaving us vulnerable on the mountainside, or just stuck here, while the raiders wreak havoc on the towns below, if not the city behind us. Tiberius is thinking the same thing. He hastens to the edge of the road, looking down into the darkness. "Can you radio your settlements? They need to be warned." "Ahead of you," Davidson barks back. He crouches over one of the wounded soldiers, holding his arm while a healer works at the man's broken leg. At the Premier's side, an officer speaks rapidly into her communications gear. Tiberius frowns, turning from the cliff back to the carnage. "And send word back to the city. Call out a second detachment. Drop jets, if they can get here in time." Davidson barely nods. I get the feeling he's already done that too, but he holds his tongue, keeping his focus on the soldier beneath him. Healers, half a dozen or so, work diligently down the line, tending to anyone injured in the massive wreck. "What about us? We can't stay up here for long." I slide off my vehicle, landing gently. It feels better to be on solid ground. Something tipped that transport. Still on the roof, Titan braces his hands on his hips. He looks at the zagging road above, investigating the otherwise empty spot the first transport fell from.
"Could be a small charge mine. Detonated at the right moment, it could flip a vehicle."
"Too clean," Tiberius growls. He paces along the road, his entire body on edge. His Larilan guards follow him a little too closely, almost catching his heels.
"Coordinated. Someone's up here with us. We need to get down before they strike again. We're sitting ducks."
"Sitting ducks on the edge of a cliff," Evangeline adds. She kicks at her own transport in frustration, putting a solid dent in the already crumpled front. "We can get the working transports up front. Load them as much as we can." Tiberius shakes his head.
"It's not enough."
"It's something," I snap at him,
We are only a few thousand feet up now. Some of the regiment can start running, get to the ground, Davidson says, helping one of the soldiers limp away from the head of the line. His communication officer follows, still jabbering into her radio. The outpost at Golden Grove has transports. It isn't far from the foot of the mountain. On the ground, Farley whirls, lowering her gun in her haste.
You want us to split up?
Not for long, Davidson replies. She pales, rising to her feet.
But long enough, if,
he asks.
If this is a trap, a feint. You got word from the towns that raiders were close. But where is the attack?
She gestures to the black horizon.
There isn't one.
Not out there. Davidson frowns, eyes shifting.
Not yet.
Or they didn't plan to attack at all. They wanted to draw us out of the city, Farley says. Catch us on the cliffs. You said yourself they fight for their pride, and the city is too well defended.
This is a hell of a way to get valuable targets out in the open. The Premier steps to her, his face grim and stern. Then he puts a hand on her shoulder, squeezing a little, a friendly if apologetic gesture.
I won't leave my people out there alone, because we might be in danger. I can't do that, General Farley. I know you understand my position.
He sighs. I expect more of a fight from Farley, but she drops her chin, almost nodding. She chews her lip and says nothing more. Satisfied, Davidson looks over his shoulder.
Captain Highcloud, Captain Villa,
he calls. Two officers in their black suits step forward, ready for their orders.
Take your units down. Hard march, all speed. Rendezvous at Golden Grove.
They salute in response, turning to gather their soldiers. As the two units group near the head of the line, Tiberius winces. He hastens to the Premier, clasping his arm, not to threaten him, but to beg. I know what fear looks like on Tiberius Calor, and I see it in him now.
Leave the gravitrons at least, he pleads, in case they decide to blow us all off the mountain.
After a brief moment of reflection, Davidson clicks his teeth.
Fine, he says.
And your highness, if you wouldn't mind,
he adds, turning to face Evangeline.
Those transports aren't going to climb over this mess without help. Use the gravitrons, too. They'll make quick work for you.
She eyes him with steel annoyance, unaccustomed to taking orders from anyone but her father. Still, she sighs and trots off to do as he wills.
What about me?
I ask, planting myself between Tiberius and Davidson. Both of them jolt, forgetting I was even here to begin with.
Stay vigilant, is all Davidson offers, shrugging. Unless you can lift a transport off the ground, there's not much any of us can do right now.
Helpful, I growl in my head. But the frustration is with myself. My ability is meant to destroy. It has no purpose right now. I'm useless for the moment. So is Tiberius. He watches Davidson stalk off, his communications officer in tow, leaving us standing alone, our backs to the wrecked hulk of my transport. Adrenaline and electricity still course through me. I have to lean against the metal, my fingers knotted together to keep from twitching.
I don't like this,
Tiberius mutters. I scoff, scuffing my new boots on the road. Stuck on a cliff, half of the soldiers gone, transports ruined, raider attack imminent, and I didn't get to finish my dinner. What's not to like? In spite of our circumstances, he grins, his smile crooked and familiar. I cross my arms, hoping he can't see me flush in the dim light. He stares at me, his eyes in intent, burning bronze, as they trace my face. Slowly, his lips fall and the smile fades as he remembers our decisions, our choices. But his stare remains, and I feel fire rise inside me, rage and want and regret in equal measure.
Don't look at me like that, Tiberius. Don't call me Tiberius, he shoots back, dropping his gaze.
I laugh bitterly. It's the name you chose. To that, he has no response, and we lapse into uneasy silence. The occasional shout or metallic groan echoes across the mountainside,
the only sound in the empty darkness. On the zagging road above us, Evangeline, her cousins, and the Gravitrons slowly leapfrog the all-terrain vehicles, moving the wrecks behind the transports that can still function. Davidson must have told her to preserve all the wrecks she could, or else she could just crush them all to dust and let the rest roll through.
"I'm sorry about before, in the armory," he says after a long moment.
He keeps his eyes on the ground, head bowed in shadow, but not enough to hide the cold flush across his cheeks.
"I shouldn't have said that."
"I don't care what you said, I care about the intention behind it," I tell him, shaking my head. "I don't belong to you."
"I think anyone with eyes can see that.
Can you?" I ask sharply. He exhales slowly, as if gathering himself for a fight. Instead, he turns his head to look down at me. The glowing lights of the Hawkway cast jagged shadows across his face, emphasizing his cheekbones. It makes him look old and tired, a king for years instead of days.
"Yes, Mayor,"
he finally says, his voice a low rumble.
"But remember, it wasn't just me."
I blink. "What?"
"You chose something over me, too," he sighs. "Many things.
The Scarlet Guard, the Red Dawn, the hope of a better future for the people I love." I bite my lip, chewing my own flesh. I have nothing to deny. Tiberius isn't wrong.
"If you two are done," Titan says loudly, leaning down from his vantage point on the transport, "I think you'd both be interested to know there are people in the trees."
I suck in a breath, tensing up. Tiberius puts out a hand quickly, touching my arm in light warning.
"Don't startle," he says. "I'm guessing they have us targeted."
Metal groans, and I jump beneath Tiberius's fingers. His grip tightens, but it's just the transports being moved.
"How many?" I ask through gritted teeth, trying my best to mask my fear.
Titan looks down at me, eyes bright. His white hair gleams in the artificial light illuminating the Hawkway. 4, 2 on each side, at a good distance, but I can just feel their brains. Next to me, Tiberius frowns, the corners of his lips curving downward in distaste. 50 yards, maybe? I look past Tiberius, and he looks past me, both of us searching the shadowed pines as furtively as we can. I can't see anything beyond our circle of light, not the gleam of eyes or the flash of steel down a gun barrel. Nothing. I can't feel them either. My ability is nowhere near as strong or as focused as Titan's. Farley catches my eye and approaches with a hand on her hip, the other still clutching her pistol.
"You three look like you've seen a ghost," she says, sweeping her gaze back and forth.
"Snipers in the trees," she offers, as if she's asking about the weather.
"Did you see them?"
Titan breathes.
"No,"
she shakes her head, "but it's what I'd do."
"You can drop them, right?"
I ask, nudging Titan's boot. I remember the Electricons taught me about his ability, brain lightning. Titan can affect the electricity in a person's body, the tiny sparks inside our brains. He can kill without anyone knowing, without any trace. He frowns and furrows his dark brows, a sharp contrast to his dyed hair.
"I might be able to, from this distance, but only one at a time," he says, "and only if they are raiders."
Tiberius scowls.
"Who else would they be up here?"
"I don't enjoy killing people without cause, Kalor,"
Titan replies, "and I've lived on these mountains my entire life."
"So you'll wait for them to shoot us?"
The prince shifts slightly, squaring his shoulders so that I'm sheltered on one side. Titan doesn't budge. As he speaks, a breeze plays up, carrying with it the strong, sharply sweet scent of pine.
"I'll wait for your Magnetron princess to tell me if they're holding sniper rifles or not."
On the one hand, I agree with Tiberius. We're exposed up here, and who else would be waiting in the trees watching us scramble? but I understand Titan, too. I know what it is to pour lightning into a person, to sense their nerves sparking off and dying. It feels like a small death of your own, an ending you can never forget. Get Evangeline, I mutter, and tell Davidson. We need to be sure. Next to me, Tiberius huffs, but he doesn't argue. He pushes off the transport, intending to stalk after Evangeline. The breeze strengthens, playing across my face. Pine needles brush my skin, soft as trailing fingers. I try to catch one, but it dances off on the growing wind, and it sprouts before my eyes, a sapling growing in midair. It spears a soldier before any of us can react. The attack is not the storm of bullets we expected, but the spray of pine needles blasting in a strong, sudden gale. It catches Titan head-on, tossing him off the wrecked transport. He rolls onto the road, head smacking against the pavement. He stumbles to a knee, then falls, oddly off balance. I throw up an arm to protect my eyes and drop to a knee as needles scratch across my exposed skin. Where they land, roots and trunks burst forth in curling, living explosions. The hawkway cracks and transports heave, tossed by the forest growing before our eyes. My balance shifts with the road, and I fight to keep upright, bracing against the wrecked transport at my back. Tiberius reacts without thinking. He tosses a fireball, charring the pines sprouting up around us as fast as they can grow. The ash swirls in the growing wind, obscuring the road lights, making my eyes water. The air shudders with the sound of crushing metal and shattering glass. Evangeline and her crew are done wasting time. They flatten the wrecks that remain in the way, reducing them to solid puddles of iron and steel. The transports that still work roar, revving their engines as they lurch forward, fighting over pulsing roots and ripping branches. Evangeline leaps through the smoky air, climbing up onto a transport frame. Gunshots ring out, but the bullets fall to the wayside, tossed off by her ability. Blue shields spring to life on either end of the hawkway, tall and ethereal against the smoke and ash. Davidson controls each one with an outthrust fist. More shots sound, rippling over the shield. They can't penetrate. The guns can't reach us. Titan! I scream, looking for the electrocon. Titan! Kill them! He hoists himself to his feet, teetering as he wags his head back and forth, trying to shake away the daze. Using the nearest transport, he props himself up, leaning heavily. Give me a second! He yells back, shaking his head again. We still can't see the raiders, safe from their nests in the trees. There have to be green wardens, at least. Tiberius's flames spread across the surge of pines on the road, twisting like a snake, attempting to devour each new tree as it sprouts. His Lariland guards run between the trunks, laying hands on each. They explode at their touch, splintering in clouds of bark and blooming fire. Get on the transports! Davidson roars over the chaos. He still holds the shields, defending us from a hail of bullets. We have to get off the mountain! I suck in a deep breath, steeling myself. Focus. In the dark, I can't see the clouds gathering overhead, but I can feel them. Storm clouds, thunderheads, growing at my command, ready to strike. Someone pulls Titan onto the approaching transport, buckling him in. On the road, Tiberius directs his inferno through the lethal forest, trying to trap us on the cliff or push us off it. The rest of our detachment does their best to dodge the trees or destroy them, clearing the way for the transports and our escape. My heart thunders against my ribcage, adrenaline charging in my blood. It rises until I feel like I might burst. I take one more breath, deeper than before, and raise my hands, palms flat. My storm breaks overhead, twin bolts of lightning shattering down into the trees on either side of the hawkway. The pines crack, embers flare, trunks slide and lean before crashing into the underbrush. Fire springs up among the boughs, small at first, then gigantic, fueled by the strength of a Kalor prince. The bullets on our left stop long enough for Davidson to drop one shield and clamber onto the transport behind Evangeline's. The six vehicles bristle with soldiers, familiar and unfamiliar. In their black suits, they look like bugs, crowding for space on a stone in the middle of a churning river. Titan hangs off the side of Evangeline's transport, one arm looped through a set of straps. As they drive past Tiberius, still fighting,
Titan extends a hand. The prince takes it without question, swinging up onto the transport with ease. I'm next. I land hard, tucked between Tiberius and Titan, with Evangeline upright above us. She fuses her metal boots to the body of the transport, which allows her to stand with confidence despite our growing speed. She clenches a fist, clearing the last wreck out of our way, slamming it against the cliffside. Glass sprays the air like jagged rain. Davidson's final shield drops, shifting from the trees ahead to the lead transport. But in that brief second, another storm of bullets peppers our convoy. A few hit dangerously close, pinging off the metal by my head. Adrenaline eats my fear. I focus on keeping my grip on the transport, fingers tight on makeshift handholds, my body pressed against the cold steel. Flame chases alongside us, flanking the cliff edge of the transport. Tiberius keeps hold of it, dragging the swirl of fire with us, charring anything in our path. We scream over the road, taking the switchbacks with blinding speed. "More in the trees!" Titan growls, his teeth gritted against the wind. He squints into the darkness, his eyes narrowing to slits. I know what he's doing, even if I can't do it myself. Titan reaches out to the brains, feeling them as I feel the storm. He blinks once, twice, killing anyone within his reach, leveling them with a fury of electricity in their skulls. I imagine raiders dropping to the forest floor, their bodies twitching through a deadly seizure before finally lying still. I rain lightning into the pines, more bolts striking through trunks and branches. The blinding flashes illuminate the forest for a moment, enough to see the silhouettes of falling trees and fleeing figures, a dozen at least. The Hawkway levels for the last mile as we leave the sharp corners and cliffs behind. The transports roar beneath us, eating up the straightaway in a mad race to the foot of the mountain. Fire and storm run with us, two guardians on deadly wings. More engines flare on the edge of my awareness, not as strong as the transports, but just as fast, and moving toward us with furious speed. The first cycle snarls out of the tree line, its single headlight blinding. The raider on it is small, with spindly limbs, armor, and goggles. He is also boldly stupid, driving the cycle up and off a boulder, sending himself arcing over the road. Above me, Evangeline slices her hands through the air. The cycle shreds at her command, spokes and pipes peeling apart. But she isn't the only magnetron here. The raider keeps his seat, and the cycle knits back together beneath his body, continuing its leap over the hood of the transport. As he goes, he tosses something. The steel glints in the dim light, fast as any bullet. Knives sail through the air, their razor edges cutting the wind. We duck together, Tiberius, Titan, and I. One grazes my shoulder. The suit saves me from the worst of it, but I still feel the sting. I bite my lip hard, forcing back a yelp of pain. The cycling raider hits the other side of the road hard, wheels skidding through dirt as he circles to make another pass. Instead, he crunches into a thin blue wall, the cycle crumpling beneath him as he falls backward, gushing blood. Davidson moves the shields with us, trying to block the other cycles spitting out of the trees. Some of the riders drop, their bodies spasming as Titan takes hold of them. The rest of our focus is on getting onto the plane, out into the open. To the outpost, our reinforcements and safety. The Montfort New Blood.